You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
And from what I'm reading in the law, it is incredibly draconian. It is quarantine, isolation, forced medical examination, forced medical treatment. And in particular, the tracking devices are really causing a stir among legal scholars right now. The new rules from August 2016 allow what is called medical tracking. It is under the definition section, they call it electronic or internet-based monitoring.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Greg Glazer. Today's show, the new CDC rules, medical surveillance. Greg Glazer is a practicing attorney headquartered in Northern California. He is a vaccine rights attorney helping doctors and parents. Today we cover the Center for Disease Control's proposed new rules, which when implemented will constitute an expansion of federal powers under the Federal Public Health Service Act. We also examine the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, elements of which have been adopted by many states, and discuss implications of the CDC's new proposed rules, along with possible responses, including a proposed new law. Greg Glazer, welcome.
Hi, Bonnie. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
On August 15th, 2016, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, invited public comment on new proposed rules under the heading of Control of Communicable Diseases, Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. What is the CDC talking about? What are these proposed new rules?
The proposed new rules are the implementation of the Federal Public Health Service Act. And the CDC currently has broad powers to apprehend people who are moving across state lines and to check them for communicable diseases and other health concerns. And these new proposed rules are an expansion of federal power. So the way the system currently works is that the federal government will investigate an outbreak. So for example, if someone is on a plane and it's known that someone has Ebola on that plane, they might stop the plane and check everyone on the plane. So that's how the system currently works. But the new proposed rules that just came out that you mentioned, they are going to instead look at every plane, regardless of whether there is Ebola on that plane or not. They're going to look at every traveler. And so the new proposed rules are an expansion of the current Public Health Service Act.
Well, now, when you say that the government is going to look at all planes, is it actually that they have the power to do that? They're not actually doing that, are they?
They are not currently doing that. Just like before there were TSA scanners, before there were those machines that you walk through at the airport, it was questionable whether or not the federal government had the power. But after the World Trade Center attacks, then the federal government stepped in and offered this quote-unquote remedy to protect people. But of course, it took away part of their civil liberties. And they didn't just target and look at terrorists, right? They looked at everyone. So the idea is the same with communicable diseases. They're not just going to be looking at the Ebola plane. They're looking at every single passenger. And so this is a dramatic shift. These proposed rules that you mentioned from August 2016 are a dramatic shift in federal policy. And they are an expansion of this current federal law called the Public Health Service Act, which does allow the government very broadly to investigate Americans to see if they have communicable diseases, quarantine individuals who have communicable diseases. And there is a specific list of diseases that are subject to these powers. And they're laid out by executive order. And on that list currently You have diseases like cholera, diphtheria, smallpox, but they're adding to the list measles. So the idea is that if you are traveling and you are suspected of having one of these diseases, like let's say it's cholera or let's say it's measles, and then you were to find yourself at a checkpoint or interacting in some way with one of these public health officers, then they would investigate you. They do a medical examination to see if you are reasonably suspected of having one of these diseases. And what that examination looks like is that you can be detained for a time period between 20 minutes and 2 hours, and they can ask you questions about your, you know, your name, where you live, about your current health. They can do a brief examination of you to see if it looks like you have a fever. They're basically looking for criteria within their definition of ill person. And this is all inside the new proposed rules. It says an ill person is someone who has a fever, feels warm to the touch, and they have a history of any of the following, like a skin rash, difficulty breathing, persistent cough. So you sort of get the idea of what they're going to be looking for. So basically, if you're going through a checkpoint and you look ill, then you can be detained. And if you are reasonably suspected of having one of these diseases on the list, say it's measles, then you go into the next step in their processing, which involves quarantine. Now, quarantine can take a couple of different avenues. The first avenue is that they can have you sign an agreement and then send you home. Say, look, just we want to monitor you. We want to make sure that you're not going to infect other people. Can you just stay home for a few days and let's see what happens with this? You know, we'll check in with your doctor and all that. So that would be a pretty friendly approach that would respect civil rights. And then there's a different approach. And this the different approach would be more of what you would expect during a serious outbreak where there's lots of people traveling with measles or lots of people traveling with one of the infectious diseases. Then they don't have the ability to send everyone home, so they send people into quarantine camps, concentration camps, which may sound very radical, but it actually is something that has happened in history, in quarantine history, if you go back about a century. So the new proposed rules, Bonnie, that you highlighted from August 2016, provide some detail on what infectious disease looks like, what quarantine looks like, who can be quarantined, who can be examined, how long an examination can take, what due process looks like for someone who wants to challenge their confinement during a quarantine. And so the rules are an expansion of government power.
Now, the CDC is claiming these new powers, I guess, by putting out these rules. They've asked for public commentary. I understand that the public comment period is now closed. I took a look at regulations.gov and saw that there are over 15,500 comments on the proposed new CDC rules, and all comments that I saw were objecting to these new CDC rules. Where do these rules stand presently?
The rules are currently under review, and the comments are currently under review. So the proposed rule was made public in August, and then public comments came out, exactly as you highlighted. And so the CDC is reviewing those comments, and then they will approve the rule soon. And once they approve the rule, then it becomes a regulation, an official regulation, and then it can be implemented. So the pattern, the historical pattern of the CDC when they do this is that they're going to approve their rules as written. They might make a few changes. They might incorporate a tiny bit of public comment. But from the past, they only make small changes to what they want to do. And usually it's just lip service that they pay. So just for example, in one of their previous changes, they had, and this isn't to this particular rule, but it was on another item that was also on quarantine. there was a big blowback, and people didn't like that the rule said that they would be controlling people during an emergency. So the CDC changed it. They said, okay, well, we'll change it. Now we're just going to be protecting people. But they didn't change any of the substance of their proposed rule. They just changed one word to make it sound more palatable. You know, it's like marketing. So we can expect the same thing here. The writing's on the wall for federal policy. They have a very clear program that they want to implement, and it dates all the way back to the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. They've done so through federal channels at John Hopkins University and Georgetown University. And we could talk about that Model Act if you like.
Yes, I do want to talk about the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. But I'm wondering, first of all, what in your view could be the initial use of these new CDC rules? That is to say, what might constitute the opening salvo? I mean, I'm assuming now they have not really rolled this out. You've mentioned travel. What does travel have to do with this?
Yes, the federal government is limited in its authority under the United States Constitution. And so the federal government often relies on the Commerce Clause, which allows them to regulate interstate commerce and travel. And so the fact that these regulations are directed toward travel helps emphasize how they will be initially utilized. Now, this is also a slippery slope when we look at it historically, but for right now, we can expect that these new rules to process individuals and check to see if they are infected with an infectious disease will be rolled out at airports and train stations and bus stations. And they are going to be looking for individuals and prepping people for what this looks like. It was the same thing with the TSA scanners. You know, you don't see TSA scanners at schools. You don't see them at the supermarket, for example, but you do see them at locations of travel because that's a place of federal authority.
Well, Greg, you mentioned the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. What has that got to do with these new CDC rules?
The Public Health Service Act, which is the federal rule that these new rules are implementing, it claims its authority under the United States Commerce Clause in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. And that means that the federal government is limited in its authority to regulate commerce between the states. So infectious disease control is considered relevant to interstate commerce. And interstate commerce even applies beyond what one would think, you know, like imagine a truck traveling from Kansas to California. You think, well, that's interstate commerce because they're traveling between states. But actually, interstate commerce has a much broader reading. The Supreme Court has found that it includes virtually all commerce. Even if you sell an apple in your local farmer's market, it has the ability to impact prices on the apple market, which is interstate commerce. It's become illogical. We lawyers laugh at how illogical it has become, but it's really no joking matter. Interstate commerce is this open door that allows the federal government to regulate wide areas of activity in American life. And infectious disease and quarantine is one of those areas.
I'm speaking to vaccine rights attorney Greg Glazer. Today's show, the new CDC rules, medical surveillance. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, how has the Commerce Clause of the Constitution been used historically?
Well, it was used historically to regulate the movement of goods between the states. So, for example, when cholera broke out in New York, and they were between New York and Maryland, and New York was just ravaged by it, Maryland wasn't, and they were trying to limit the goods that were transferred from one state to the next. Interstate commerce stepped in for that purpose. That's a public health example. But just overall, interstate commerce has related to things like making it so that one state won't create a barrier to trade with another state, like imposing tariffs. And interstate commerce has also been applied to implement federal policies against discrimination on the basis of race, for example. One famous case was of a hotel owner in Mississippi or somewhere. And the hotel owner said that he wanted to discriminate against African Americans. And the federal government said, well, you're not allowed to do that under federal law. He said, well, I'm not engaged in interstate commerce. They said, well, by just virtue of you having a hotel, you're engaged in interstate commerce. He said, fine, I'll only take Mississippians. They said, it doesn't matter. You still are affecting interstate commerce, even if you only operate within the state. So the Commerce Clause has been a way for the federal government to reach into the states and promote federal policy. And so even though it started off as being about tariffs and other things, it has quickly become about all federal policies. And so virtually, I don't want to put a percentage on it, but I would guess above 95% of all federal law can be traced back to the Commerce Clause.
Well, how did the Commerce Clause come to have such power? Why is the Commerce Clause of the Constitution used this way? What started that?
That's a great question. One of the most famous ways that the Commerce Clause became relevant in history from a lawyer's standpoint was during the New Deal, when President Roosevelt wanted to present his New Deal legislation, which included all sorts of government programs to, you know, fix the roads and give people employment, get them into the Civilian Conservation Corps, sending money back home, taking people out of the cities, and getting them into the country. You know, these were federal programs that were very controversial at the time. And the states said, no way, you can't do that. You're stepping into our domain. These are usually state rules. Federal government said, no, we have this power under the Commerce Clause. And there was a series of decisions at the time which ruled against Roosevelt. So Roosevelt said, okay, I'm going to pack the court. You have 9 judges right now. I'm going to increase the number to 15. So I'll get the number of judges that I want. And then the court said, okay, fine. We will agree with your New Deal legislation. We will rule that it is allowed under the Commerce Clause. And so it's that slippery slope. Once they changed the logic, you know, they went beyond the plain meaning of the words to allow this New Deal legislation, then it just opened the door. And then they couldn't shut the door after that. It just allowed the floodgates into federal rules. And, you know, it's credited with getting America out of the Great Depression, for one. But also it helped build the military-industrial complex later and other aspects. It's been a mixed bag. You know, the states are some of the worst oppressors of all of civil rights. So on some level, federal law has been helpful. On other levels, it's created this massive military-industrial complex. But yeah, the Commerce Clause has been the procedural mechanism to implement federal law.
So let's say that these new CDC rules go into effect, or these rules are adopted. I guess at the present time, that's not the case. But let's say that they go into effect. And then what would happen? They would be able to use these new rules during some sort of health emergency. What could constitute a health emergency?
They can use the rules whether there's a health emergency or not. Under the Public Health Service Act, by executive order, they are allowed to investigate any case of infectious disease, even one case of cholera or one case of tuberculosis, single case of measles is enough to justify federal power. But the extent of the response will depend on whether you're dealing with one case or 10,000 cases. So a reasonable response to one case might be considered different for 10,000 cases. So the answer to your question of what does it look like when these rules are rolled out among the states and in federal territories, it looks like the government beginning with travel, where they set up these public health workers or public health officers, and they will be screening all passengers for signs of infectious disease. And anyone can report on this. So that means the stewardess can report on it, or a pilot, or, you know, a TSA agent. And then probably also means there's going to be federal funding. So at the same TSA checkpoint, you know, where there's a long line, they're going to have a camera on you. And if you're sniffling, if you look unwell, then you might get pulled out of line and then brought into a room and then questioned for 20 minutes to 2 hours, possibly asked to give a urine sample or to provide other information that can incriminate you, basically. But also, you know, for them, it's just public health monitoring. And then if you're suspected of having an infectious disease, the way these rules work is that they give you a proposed agreement. And this is also unprecedented. It's causing quite a stir. The federal government will give you a piece of paper called an agreement where they tell you that you will agree to all of their quarantine rules. So you will agree to go to such and such camp, or you will agree to stay at home, or you will agree to such and such treatment if it's necessary. And they will present this to you as if you had to sign it before you leave. And so the answer to part of your question, Bonnie, is that nobody really knows what this looks like because it's unprecedented. But they did lay out some specifics in their plan for what those quote unquote voluntary agreements look like.
Well, what are some of those specifics? Is that what you were just talking about?
Yes. Yeah, in the voluntary agreement, they can lay out what kind of measures you will agree to. So they will be saying things like, you agree to wear a wearable tracking device, for example, like a bracelet that can track you. Or you agree to respond to our emails every day to check on the status. You agree to the installation of a video monitoring. You know, so they will give you, you know, a little pack to take home, which will include a little webcam or something like that. And you will agree to report to your health officer until the conclusion of your detention. And they can also make it so that you will agree to consult with a doctor or maybe even their own doctor. So part of the rules are very general as to what can be contained in these voluntary agreements. And then part of it is specific. So I'll just, might be helpful if I read it to you. It says the CDC may enter into an agreement with an individual upon such terms as the CDC considers to be reasonably necessary, indicating that the individual consents to any of the public health measures authorized under this part, including quarantine, isolation, conditional release, medical examination, hospitalization, vaccination, and treatment, provided that the individual's consent shall not be considered as a prerequisite to the exercise of any authority under this part, close quote. So that tells you that the federal government is claiming the ability to get you to agree to anything. This is a time when civil rights lawyers are concerned because the risk is very high of the government violating our civil rights.
Are there organizations or attorney groups that you're aware of that have voiced concern with regard to these new CDC rules?
Yes, there are. One of the most prominent among them is a group called the National Health Freedom Action, and they are basically a coalition of many different health freedom groups and interests to make a point about how these proposed rules from August 2016, how these rules are violating civil rights. And they make it very clear that these rules are unprecedented in terms of how far they go, just like TSA screening was unprecedented at the time. And they make it clear that there's a deep risk that people will be confused by these voluntary agreements where they're agreeing to medical treatment before they even know what that treatment is. And then they lay out what they would like to see for due process, where people are allowed to say that they don't want forced medication, that they would prefer to be at home, and that the government will respect their rights. And it's very interesting that the government has not made it explicit in their rules that they will respect rights, that they won't force medication on the people. And so the government and the people have this tenuous relationship when it comes to quarantine and forced vaccination. And so the groups that are opposed to this are very deep. I gave you one example, but yeah, there's many. who submitted comments, just as you saw when you saw there were over 10,000 comments.
Well, now, has the ACLU weighed in on this?
They have. The ACLU, through, in particular, prominent professors at Boston University, has said that they want a public health approach to quarantine rather than a police state approach to quarantine. And they made a whole presentation about it. And it's kind of interesting because you almost have to be careful what you wish for. Because in 2008, when they made their initial presentation, they said that the CDC didn't give clear guidelines on what they would do during quarantine and during infectious disease outbreak. So, you know, again, be careful what you wish for, because then when the CDC comes out with their clear guidelines, the clear guidelines violate civil rights. And they didn't respect the ACLU. And now it's been months since the proposed rules came out, and we haven't heard any word from the ACLU that they're planning on challenging it. But then again, the rules haven't been implemented yet. So time will tell whether any lawyers group actually challenges this. And the CDC needs to be limited. And the only group at this time that can limit them is Congress. So we need to take action.
You've talked about these agreements that, let's say these rules go into effect, you're suspected of being sick or maybe you have some disease or something, and then you agree to all of these measures and sign this thing. Well, what if you say, I don't agree? What happens then?
Then the CDC still has all of its other powers. So the agreement is just a convenient way for them to create evidence against you. So if you don't agree, then you're basically an antagonist to them. So you don't know what that looks like. There's ways to successfully be adversarial, where you say, look, I'm not going to agree to any of this stuff. You need to let me go right now. I want to speak with my lawyer. I want to speak with my doctor. And then if you do it correctly, they would take you seriously and respect your rights. So there is a way to do it right. But there's also the possibility that they don't respect you and they bring down the full weight of the Public Health Service Act against you, in which case you get churned by the system. So they put you into all the things that I said. You know, you've got your 2-hour detention and questioning, and they make you give a urine sample, and then you go off to a camp where they forcefully medicate you, and you go to your administrative tribunal where some guy wearing a military uniform says, nope, you're supposed to be here, next case. And then you're just stuck.
Well, so we don't really know whether or not your rights are going to be respected or not.
Exactly, because it's unprecedented. And the TSA example is pretty useful because we know that these body scanners have been legitimized. And people have accepted them. And there's not some great challenge out there that is promoting civil rights and bringing us back to the way things were before the World Trade Center attacks. This is the new world order. This is how things are done. And so what the next pandemic brings is going to be a real test to the Republic of the United States.
I'm speaking to vaccine rights attorney Greg Glaser. Today's show, the new CDC rules, medical surveillance. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Obviously, the assumption is that these new guidelines, these new CDC rules would be rolled out if there was a pandemic or something. But does there really have to be a pandemic for the CDC to start using these new rules on the public?
Technically, a pandemic is not required. The new rules can be rolled out even for one isolated case of measles. Now, the likelihood of that happening is pretty low. And if there was just one case of measles, then you can expect the response is going to be very light. You'd get stopped at the airport. They'd say, look, you have the measles. You got to go home. Here's your voluntary agreement. Can you go see your doctor and then please report back to us on a daily basis till we know this is taken care of? You know, they'll just be doing test cases like that. So I don't think we're going to see the full weight of this federal authority until we get to the first the actual outbreak that happens from whatever source derived, whether it's outbreak caused by vaccines or outbreak caused by terrorism or outbreak just caused for natural reasons, whatever the source, then we'll know what real federal power looks like in this area. And from what I'm reading in the law, it is incredibly draconian. It is quarantine, isolation, forced medical examination, forced medical treatment. And in particular, the tracking devices are really causing a stir among legal scholars right now. The new rules from August 2016 allow what is called medical tracking. It is under the definition section, they call it electronic or internet-based monitoring. And it means that if you are one of those individuals who get stopped, let's say you're just driving your car and you go over a bridge and there happens to be a checkpoint there. And then you get stopped. They say, you know, please pull over into this lane. And then they ask you some questions. A public health officer asks you some questions. So during this stop, where you are at the bridge and you don't have the ability to leave, you will quickly find that your civil rights are in jeopardy, which is the whole point, which is the whole problem that civil rights lawyers are worried about today.
You mentioned the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. I remember this shortly after 9/11, September 11th, 2001, there was a lot of talk about this Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, and there was talk about the state of California or the states enacting this act, and then the discussion about it sort of went away, and I haven't heard anything about it since. What is the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, and was this rolled out after September 11th?
Yes, it was rolled out after September 11th, and it is proposed legislation. It's federally funded, so basically it's a proposed law that came from the Pentagon, and it was put through the Center for Law and Public Health at Georgetown and Johns Hopkins. They're like the front organization, the front university, that took the funding and then made this proposed law. And it came from law professors Lawrence Gostin and David Fidler. They were kind of the front men for it. And Hillary Clinton's health task force was involved. And this proposed law came out and it was cleared for publication in March of 2001. But they waited until September 2001 after the World Trade Center attacks to publish it. And it was a radical departure from previous rules on quarantine. And it granted massive power to the state to force individuals to undergo medical examinations, to track them, including their genetic information, force them to be vaccinated, treated, quarantined, mandating all healthcare providers report cases, so reporting on each other, forcing pharmacists to report unusual, even prescription rates. Just, it was like this full-on approach to quarantine and infectious disease that was rolled out right after the World Trade Center attacks. And just very suspicious that it had that timing. Also, the fact that it was funded by the Pentagon should help clue you into what's really going on behind the scenes here. This is part of the military-industrial complex. And quarantine is not some small thing that just never happens. If it does become relevant, it'll become relevant to basically everyone in America at the same time. So it has this huge potential for impact. It's like a sleeping giant that can just lie dormant. So anyway, this proposed law that came from the Pentagon called the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, it has been implemented in part among 50 states, some more than others. Some of my research shows that about 38 states and Washington, D.C. have passed parts of it. But overall, it really never took off. It never got fully accepted by the states because it's hard to pass model legislation in every state. And the reason why they wanted to pass it in every state, in addition to being the fact that they are the military-industrial complex, is because traditionally quarantine and public health comes from the states. These are state laws. And so it was thought that the public would only accept and the courts would only allow these public health measures if they came as state laws. But the notice of proposed rulemaking that we were discussing earlier in the show today from August 2016, that is a federal regulation. So there's this state-federal dichotomy here. But yeah, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act would be a state law, and it is incredibly draconian when you read it. I've read both parts of it, its original form and its later form, is they call it Turning Point. And it says in no uncertain terms, you can be forcefully vaccinated. You can be forcefully required to go into a camp. They pay just lip service to what due process looks like. So if you want to challenge your incarceration during the time of your quarantine, then you get a military tribunal. So it's the same things that we were talking about earlier in this show. That's what this model law was. So you can see they come from the same source, which is what our research shows.
Well, what has the California legislature adopted out of the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act?
The answer to that is on a table.
The new CDC rules are just going to supersede all of this. Are they going to need this Model State Emergency Health Powers Act?
Yes, because there are multiple layers of authority. The new rules relate to the federal government's authority, and the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act relates to state law.
I see.
So California has implemented aspects of the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, more than just one definition. They have enacted in 2003, they enacted the California Health Tracking Act, which allows statewide health tracking, which integrates their data systems, and it gets the agencies working together to target areas which they feel are most in need of infectious disease control measures. That's one example of how they implemented the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. This was from 2005, they authorized local police officers to enforce the orders of the Department of Public Health and local health officers for the purpose of preventing the spread of contagious disease. So that means that the California Department of Public Health is not just some small government agency. Now they get to spread their wings, because now every local cop can enforce their orders. So that gives them boots on the ground, which is a big deal. And then California has implemented other aspects of the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act as well.
And then would military tribunals be a part of the government response to a pandemic or a health emergency under this Model State Emergency Health Powers Act?
Absolutely. That was one of the big points in the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. They wanted to lay out a clear system for those military tribunals so that it would give legitimacy to what they're trying to accomplish. Because they were afraid that a court would strike down their whole system. Just think about it. You can take people right off the street, take them away from their family, disrupt their custody over their children, and then just house them all because they're resisting a vaccination. I mean, this is incredibly draconian. And so the federal government was very worried that they wouldn't have this power, that a court would strike it down. So they wanted to be very detailed in their proposed law here by saying that they were going to give due process and make sure that the individual had plenty of time to subpoena witnesses and present evidence, and there'd be a hearing. But this is all just for the surface. It's all just so that the law would pass scrutiny under the Constitution, if ever reviewed by a court.
What, if any, safeguards are built into this Model State Emergency Health Powers Act? Is there any provision in it for the individual to fight back or to go to court or resist?
Yes, the individual can go to court, but the court itself is only a military tribunal. What that means is that the court is like a conference room and instead of a judge, there is a military officer. And the normal rules of court do not apply, meaning that you don't have a complaint, you don't have normal discovery. It's all separate military rules. So it's closed hearing and that type of thing. So the answer to your question is that those are the only safeguard available to an individual who does find themselves in one of these quarantine camps.
I'm speaking to vaccine rights attorney Greg Glaser. Today's show, the new CDC rules, medical surveillance. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, I know that you have talked about self-quarantine. What is self-quarantine?
Yes, self-quarantine is a good thing. It is recommended by the ACLU, and it is the situation where an individual decides to stay at home if they have an infectious disease or if they are suspected of having an infectious disease. So that means that the individual doesn't go to a quarantine camp. They aren't required to go to a hospital either. They simply stay put. That's called home quarantine or self-quarantine.
And who did you say was promoting a self-quarantine? And do you have that right in case of some kind of a pandemic currently?
Yeah, it was the ACLU that proposed it, and we do not currently have the right explicitly. And this has been part of the problem, actually, that the lawyers for the ACLU have been saying, let's just make it very clear that we have the right to self-quarantine. Let's put it in the law that we have that right. But the government said, no, we won't give people the right to self-quarantine. Maybe we'll allow it. We're not ruling it out, but we're going to take it on a case-by-case basis. So that's been a real problem.
Now, is there a movement or a group that is promoting self-quarantine? And if so, what are they doing?
Yes, the ACLU is definitely continuing to promote self-quarantine. And I don't know what they're doing about it yet because the rule hasn't been implemented yet. But after the rule is implemented, the ACLU might sue. And also, I am working with a group called the Pandemic Response Project, and we have written a proposed law that would allow individuals the right to self-quarantine during any emergency, whether it's a natural disaster that relates to an infectious disease or some type of infectious disease outbreak by terrorism or anything, any reason at all. An individual is free to self-quarantine during the outbreak. And also they have an absolute right to refuse forced medical treatment, any forced tracking device. So our organization, PREP, Pandemic Response Project, has written a proposed law, and we have presented it to a congressman to see if they will move it forward in the United States Congress.
Oh, that's very interesting. So you have a proposed law that your group or a group you're affiliated with is proposing for what, a federal law?
That is correct. This would be a federal law, and it is a direct response to these proposed rules that we've been talking about on this show. And it would limit the power of the CDC dramatically so that individuals can know and be sure that they have the ability to go home to their families, to stay with their families, that they have the right to refuse medical treatment. Our goal is to make this law and these rights part of something that Americans can call their own, just like we have our Miranda rights, and we know that we don't have to just give up those rights during any particular time. They just travel with us. And it would be the same thing with these rights that we are proposing that can travel with you no matter where you go in America.
Oh, I see. So then the Pandemic Response Project is in response to the new CDC rules that we've been discussing. Where could people find out more about the Pandemic Response Project?
Yes, I would recommend that they can visit our website for this proposed law, And we call it homesteadselfquarantine.org.
Now, are there any laws that mandate vaccination in the event of an emergency? What is the role of the World Health Organization?
Yeah, that's a great question. According to the Congressional Research Service, there's no federal law or federal program that mandates vaccination at any time. But with that said, the federal government has also reserved the right to make one, to make a forced vaccination program. Also, President Obama has said the same thing about the flu shot that they've been working on, you know, a flu vaccine, and that it'll be a voluntary program. But no federal official or federal law has come out and said that they will not do forced vaccination. It's just this very ambiguous area of the law. And it's the same at the World Health Organization. They have a system in place that empowers nation states and also their own health officers to implement infectious disease control measures. And yeah, mandatory vaccination has been one of the tools used by nation states to inoculate the public.
But now forced vaccination would be a power that the CDC would appropriate for itself if it, in fact, it implements these new rules that they've proposed. Isn't that right?
I think so, yes. I think that the answer to that question involves reading between the lines. So, for example, if we go to the CDC website today on this proposed rule, they have an FAQ section. And in the FAQ section, it says that they have no plans to force vaccinate the public. Yet, we can read between the lines because in their own proposed rule, it says that they do have the ability to force vaccination and treatment. So it's like they have a PR marketing arm that's doing their website, and then they have the actual law itself, which is what I would focus on personally, the law. And the law itself is very draconian. It's very state deferential, and it does allow forced vaccination.
Oh, it does. So the new rules from a legal angle would allow it, but it doesn't mandate it specifically. It doesn't state that.
Exactly.
What are hospital public-private partnerships? How would they go into effect, and where does the funding come from?
Yeah, this is a very interesting area of the law. So the United States government has an emergency preparedness policy, and that involves stockpiling drugs and medical supplies. It's called the Strategic National Stockpile. And when emergency preparedness plans are implemented, what happens is you have tiered levels of public and private partnerships where hospitals are taking their orders from various departments of the U.S. government, such as the HHS and FEMA, and the whole infrastructure is built around the idea of these funding programs. And the authority for each program is triggered by different events, such as, you know, bioterrorism or natural disaster. So I'll give you an example. They have a hospital preparedness program, which is run by the HHS, and it's provided billions to state and local governments to work with private healthcare facilities, you know, hospitals, to ensure regional surge capacity in the event of a mass casualty incident. So what that means is that the states are partnering with hospitals, local hospitals, and the states are partnering with the federal government to get federal funds to make their hospitals able to handle patients in the event of an emergency. And that means patients from anywhere. Like, you don't have to have a card to go to that hospital. You don't have to be a patient of that hospital, or your doctor doesn't have to go there. You can go to any hospital during a mass casualty incident, like Katrina. You know, hospitals would take anyone. And they have federal funding for that. So the answer to your question of what does a public-private partnership look like, it looks exactly like that, where the federal government provides the funds down through the tiers from the state government to the local government to the hospital. So the money flows down, as do the rules. So the rules for what the hospitals have to do that also comes from the federal government. That means that if the federal government says you have to forcefully vaccinate people, well, then the hospitals will do it.
You have a petition at change.org entitled Stop CDC Loopholes of Forced Medication Quarantine and Human Microchipping. Do the new CDC proposed regulations include human microchipping?
Yes. In my read of the document, yes. The new proposed rules allow electronic or internet-based monitoring. And it's defined as mechanisms or technologies allowing for a temporary public health supervision of an individual under conditional release. And it may include electronic mail, SMS text, video conference, and then the list just keeps going until you get to the worst ones. Then you get to wearable tracking technologies and other mechanisms or technologies as determined by the director. So you go from the very simple ones in the beginning, like email. Okay, everyone's okay with that, right? Then you get to wearable tracking technologies. That's the worst one on the list. But another one that's even worse is other mechanisms or technologies. So what's worse than a wearable tracking technology, like a wearable bracelet? You know, so for example, if you went to a hospital today, you know, you checked in as a patient, they give every patient today a wearable bracelet. And it has your medical record number on there. The nurse comes around. She scans your bracelet. This is done in all hospitals. She scans your bracelet. It pulls up your medical record. It shows if you're due for any meds, shows, you know, when your next appointment is, if you're going up to clinic. It's got all your details in there. So that's just how it's done today. It's been done that way actually for, you know, a decade at least. And then there are other mechanisms as well that they can do. So what does that look like? Does that involve microchipping? Does that involve it just says other mechanisms or technologies. And so this has caused quite a stir among lawyers and researchers as to what that means. And it's frankly just irresponsible and dangerous that the federal government is claiming the authority to implement other mechanisms or technologies over the human body that's worse than wearable tracking technologies.
Dr. Richard Pan, California State Senator and pediatrician, a sponsor of the draconian California SB 277 that repealed the personal belief and religious exemption to vaccination for attendance at public and private schools, is sponsoring new legislation. What is it? Do you know?
Yes. Dr. Pan is one of the most dangerous men in California. He is proposing new legislation, and it's very early. So far, he's only done a town hall meeting, to my knowledge. And his law, his new law, is called the Children's Bill of Rights. And this law says that your child has the right to be vaccinated. So think about that for a second. What does that mean? That means that if you as a parent choose that your child will be natural, meaning unvaccinated, then Dr. Pan's law comes in and says your child has the right to be vaccinated. So parent, if you are exercising your opinion that the child should be natural, then you're violating your child's right to be vaccinated. So that creates an adversarial relationship between parent and child, and it allows the state to step in and enforce the child's rights not to be abused by their parent. And the parent, of course, would be abusing their child by not vaccinating them.
Well, by implication, would it also mean that a child could request a vaccination and they could be vaccinated without their parents' consent? I mean, that's what it sounds like.
Yes, yeah, and that itself has become a growing area of the law as well, where doctors have questions as to when a child can provide consent to vaccination. There's no great consensus right now, but it's about 12, age 12.
So, in conclusion, could you explain why the primary battleground to deal with these new rules or policy is in the legislature?
Yes. The legislature is right at the forefront of taking away our rights, but also recognizing our rights. And so the ability of the legislature to specify that we cannot be forcefully microchipped, that would be a wonderful step forward. And in fact, Hawaii has passed a law to that exact effect. And so the legislature has proven to represent the people when they when they want. They can also represent corporate interests like Big Pharma when they want. So they are the battleground for the health freedom movement on issues of forced vaccination.
Greg Glaser, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bon.
You've been listening to Greg Glaser. Today's show has been The New CDC Rules, Medical Surveillance. Greg Glaser is a practicing attorney headquartered in Northern California. He is a vaccine rights attorney helping doctors and parents. For more information about the Pandemic Response Project, visit homesteadselfquarantine.org. That's homesteadselfquarantine.org. Attorney Greg Glaser blogs at calvaccinefreedom.wordpress.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaro Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now, the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then you we will stand, and divided we will fall, cause love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call for all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look within inside yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Hi, this is Ken. 4 years ago, on Election Day 2012, our show featured the Fire Sign Theater, with a sketch of theirs somewhat related to an election. Today, Election 2016 is as big a bummer as Election 2012 was, and twice as weird. The wisest course would be to hear the Fire Sign Theater show again. God Save the Republic, What's Left of It, and Here We Go. Welcome to New World Notes. And who is your host?
Melanie Haber. You may remember her as Audrey Farber.
Audrey Farber?
Susan Underhill?
Susan Underhill?
How about Betty Jo Bielowski?
Betty Jo Bielowski. I hadn't heard that name since college. Everyone knew her as Nancy.
And with that gag, we mark the passing of Peter Bergman and celebrate what he added to American life. He and three others who together gave us the Fire Sign Theater. Peter Bergman, Phil Austin, Philip Proctor, and David Osman created the Fire Sign Theater in the mid-1960s. Their subject was American life and American culture, including American politics. They stressed the absurdity of our culture. They especially stressed how much our perception of reality is twisted by clichés from our omnipresent commercial media. If you're listening to this show on the radio in Central Connecticut, it's Election Day. Our presidential campaigns just embody the whole bizarre spectacle of American culture that the Fire Sign Theater points out. Today we'll hear parts of their 1970 recording, Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers. There's an election in here too, and Porgy Tirebiter's father Adolf is running for either dog killer or people's commissioner. Here's the plot, such as it is. Late at night, retired actor George Leroy Tirebiter is changing TV channels. He sees snippets of televangelist programs and game shows, commercials galore, and two old movies starring him, playing simultaneously on two different channels. One is a war movie, Parallel Hell. The other is a comedy about all-American teenagers, High School Madness. Of course, one movie blends into the other, and both blend into reality. And we have a beautiful critique of American corporate-controlled culture, politics, justice, education, and military adventures abroad. Without further ado, let's see what's on the tube.
The Howl of the Wolf Movie. Presenting honest stories of working people as told by rich Hollywood stars.
This morning's wacky feature, Porgy and Mudhead in High School Madness, with Dave Kasman as Porgy and Joe Bertman as Mudhead.
He's a spy and a girl delighter. Porgy, firefighter, he's a student like you. If you're looking for a captain of the ring ball team, you can bet he won't be there. You'll find him popping off at Pop's Sodium Shop to trim a red with red hair. Doobie-doo-wah, Porgy, firefighter. Just a student like you.
Like me?
Just a student like you.
Stop singing and finish your homework.
Just a student like you.
Adolf, come and get it. Your clam cakes are getting damp.
10-4, Eleanor.
Whew! Defoliating a victory garden certainly works up an appetite.
You sit down, Father, and dig right in.
That's right. This afternoon I'll be able to start digging the pit. If I can get some work out of that boy of yours, I can have the bunker finished by Election Day. Where is Porgy anyway?
He's up in his room, helping Porcelain make the bed.
Oh, Porgy! Oh, my!
Porgy! Porgy, tell you my...
He's coming, Mother!
He's so good with the servants, Fred.
Stop calling me Fred. My name's Adolf.
Oh, bombs away, Dad. Morning, Mom.
Morning, sir.
Oh, hot dog, road cakes again. Heavy on the 30 weight, Mom.
Don't eat with your hands, son. Use your entrenching tool.
Oh, gee, Dad, I'm just trying to save time. It isn't every day a guy graduates from high school.
How many times have I heard that before?
Well, you boys fight it out among yourselves.
Okay, Mother.
Look at the time. I've got to dress for my bridge club.
Gee, Mom, isn't that bridge built yet?
No, son. And it won't be until free hands on both sides of the big ditch can press the same button at the same time.
Okay, Dad, I give. Oh, boy, can I eat my breakfast now?
Only if you stay out of trouble, boy. Your shenanigans could cost me this election.
Well, come on, Dad. No Irishman can stop you from getting to be dog killer this time. You're unnatural.
Don't wolf your food.
Oh, there's Mudhead. Graduation, here I come. So long, Dad. Keep flying.
Oh, that son of mine.
He's not your son, Fred.
Stop torturing me, Ethel.
Come on, step on it, Mudhead.
Oh, I'd love to, Porgy, but I got my two tones through the floorboard already.
Well, okay, then we could take the shortcut through Frogtown.
All right, we could stop off at Pop's and dig some jugs.
Some what?
Oh, that Louise Wong's got a balcony you could do Shakespeare from.
Aw, not now, Mudhead. They need me at the last meeting of the Philatelist Club.
I didn't know you masturbated.
Aw, creepies, Mudhead. Where's your school spirit?
That's in the rumble seat. Want to snort?
Oh, very funny.
Sure is.
Gee, everybody at Moore Science High is an extracurricular activity but you.
Well, doesn't Louise count?
Only to 10, Mudhead. You know, that's just it.
Just what?
Well, we're the leaders of tomorrow.
Yeah, but it's today.
Well, yeah, but what are you going to do tomorrow after we graduate?
Oh, well, I thought maybe I'd go out and find a bunch of guys who dress alike and follow them around.
What?
Or I could go pick up a couple girls.
Oh, is that all you think about, picking up things?
Yeah.
Golly, Mudhead. Don't you remember what Principal Boo put down at the pep rally yesterday?
Principal Boo?
P-E-P-E-P-O.
Thank you, fellow kids.
Quiet.
In addressing for the assembly this morning, thank you. I am recalling the words of the founder of Moore Science High School, Yucaipa Heap, who pressed the first bricks with his own hands. Knowledge for the people, he said. Give them a light, and they'll follow it anywhere. We think that is a fair and a wise guy rule to be guided by.
What is reality?
And we're not afraid of it, are we?
Eat it!
You bet.
Eat it raw!
Raw, raw, raw. That's the spirits we have here. Okay, so come on, kids. Line up, sign up, and re-enlist today. Because we need more schooling, for more students, for more science high. Thank you.
So you see, Mudhead, it's like the pooper said. With counter-subversive educational priorities the way they are, well, it really helps our side to re-enlist.
Is that what you're going to do?
Oh, hell no. Right after I graduate, I'm going to cut the soles off my shoes, sit in a tree, and learn to play the flute.
Hey, look, Porgy!
Watch it!
Where are you going to graduate from?
Holy Mudhead Mackerel! More Science High! It's disappeared!
Peter,
Technical difficulties are preventing the continuation of tonight's Fox Owl feature, High School Madness. We are working on the problem.
Shoes for industry.
Shoes for the dead.
Shoes for industry.
Hi, I'm Joe Beats. Hey, what chance does a returning deceased war veteran have for that good-paying job, more sugar, and the free mule you've been dreaming of? Well, think it over. Then take off your shoes. Now you can see how increased spending opportunities means harder work for everyone. And more of it, too. So do your part today, Joe. Join with millions of your neighbors and turn in your shoes.
For industry.
Well, jumping jujubes, Porgy, it looks like a wasteland. There's nothing left but the flagpole.
I don't know what to say, Mudhead.
Hi, Mudhead.
Oh, hi, Bottles.
I know who did this. It was those bullies at Communist Martyrs High School. That's who.
Oh, come on, Bottles. We don't know who did it.
Oh, that's right. I have a very good idea.
Hey, Porgy. Porgy, you're a white man. You've got to help us. Yeah, Porgy, what? Yeah, right. What do you think? What do you think we ought to... What do you think we should do?
Yeah, what do you think, Porgy?
Well,
yeah.
Gee, I don't think we should jump to any conclusions
hey,
or take a...
Hey, Porgy! Hey, Porgy! Think about poops on your radio. Turn the car radio. Poops on.
Okay, well, gather around, kids. Just stay on camera. We'll all listen together.
All of us want to know, just as much as I want to know, who's responsible?
Communist Martyrs High School,
and
that's who.
Until we do, I must make my dirty duty clean, clear, and announce the suspendering of the upcoming graduating exercises.
Oh, no.
Which aren't taking place.
I'm never going to get out of here.
But don't worry. Your food, housing, insecurity will be guaranteed by your Department of Redundancy Department and the Natural Guard.
Hey, they're going to surround us.
And remember, trust reppers will be persecuted. So please stay where you are. Don't move. And don't panic. Don't take off your shoes. Jobs is on the way.
Golly.
Thank you. Now, here's a
hold
record
it.
That I think...
Hey, hold it
really
down,
did.
Kids. Hold it down. Don't get excited.
Who's excited?
Listen, the only way we're going to get the school back is us. I've got a really swell idea.
I'm sorry, we have lost the picture portion of our pitch mission. However, we will continue with the sound.
That's why he's so mean. Oh, well, yes. Well, what else happened in history today, Hugh?
In history, Patty, well, today, of course, is the 38th of Cunegonda. And on this day in 1938 B.C., Mr. George Antrobus invented the wheel.
And just in time.
And in 1889, the Peace of Humus broke out, ending the Hundred Years' War against the cows.
Yep.
And last year, Patty, you and the viewers will be interested in noting that the world ended.
As we know it, Hugh.
You're darn tootin', Patty.
I sure am.
Say, who was born today?
Nobody, Hugh.
I mean in history, Patty, before they changed the water.
Hey. Hey, Sarge.
Yeah?
How long have Pico and Alvarado been out on patrol?
Since 1400.
Jeez. That's 2,000 years.
I hope they can find their way back. I'm getting hungry.
Hit the dirt! Look out! Was that one of ours? Yeah. Beans. Last of the beans.
I'm so tired of Chinese food.
Hey, Sergeant Medensky, come over here. We got a problem.
Yeah? What is it, Lieutenant Tirebiter?
Silverberg here won't go over Pork Chop Hill.
Killing pigs ain't kosher, Sarge.
Canned a wise lip, Silverberg. None of us ain't going nowhere until that patrol gets back.
Talk.
Personally, I'm worried about Pico and Alvarado.
Well, don't make a career out of it.
Don't let it get to you, Lieutenant.
I'm all right, Medensky. Listen. Those good boys found their way out of East L.A. They can find their way back into this Goop Valley, right?
Sarge, something's moving out in the woods.
Where?
At Sector N.
Okay, give them the password, Sarge.
Yeah, I better disguise my voice. Hey, Joe! Who won a second of World War, you so smart?
Not responsible! Perk and lock it!
Hey, it's okay, sir. That's Pico and Alvarado. All right. Come on in, boys. Hey, don't run into trenches. Watch out for that entrenching tool.
All right, stand easy, men.
Help me up.
How was it out there?
Weird.
We've been shooting reds and yellows all day.
Oh, boy, am I sleepy.
What about the gooks?
Bad news, Lieutenant. There are gooks all around here.
They live here, Lieutenant. They got women and pigs and gardens and everything.
I was talking to this one little gook.
That's well, Corporal Kid. But we got orders to surround these little gooks.
That'll be easy, Lieutenant. There's millions of them on all three sides of us.
That means we got those little gooks right where we want them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and tonight's the planting moon. Several one of them is going to be out waiting in the paddies.
Me too.
Hey, this sounds like a perfect setup. What are we going to do, Lieutenant?
What are we going to do, Lieutenant?
What are we going to do, Lieutenant?
All right. Men, we're going to deploy it. 0800.
Check.
Recon all LOM sectors.
Check.
Bring up the 455s.
Pull.
Locate our fire perimeters.
Bonk.
Make a clean sweep. Flush out the enemy and...
What's that, sir?
Sir, Lieutenant, excuse me, sir. What are we going to do, man?
Yeah, after we flush them out.
We're going to lock and load, Private. And we're going to go out there and...
Hey, man, what are we going to do, man?
What are we doing when we lock and load?
Lieutenant. Take it easy. It's all right. You got to take it easy. It's not your fault. Come on, Borgie!
Ettrix with Nurse Warren. Don't you remember what I told you at the lake last summer?
Gee, Dad. Dad, I told you I was sorry then, and I'm sorry now.
Does Peggy know that?
Who's Peggy?
We'll return to The Painful Threshold after this message.
And if you've just tuned in and are wondering what is going on, New World Notes is playing Parts of a Critique of American Culture by the Fire Sign Theater. In part, it's about Americans' confusion of real life with the phony images and cliché stories from the mass media. And that seemed to be a pretty good way to mark Election Day 2012. We'll pick up with the movie on TV, High School Madness. Porgy, Mudhead, and their girlfriend, Bottles, have found their missing high school. It's been disassembled and stored inside the rival Communist Martyrs High School. This leads to the arrest and trial of Porgy Tirebiter, which gets thoroughly confused with the court-martial of Lieutenant Tirebiter in the other movie on the other channel. We now return to our feature.
Mudhead, we found it.
Our old alma mater. It's been taken apart and stacked up. And labeled!
This has never happened to any other high school ever before.
Hey, Porgy.
What?
Look at this big thing over here.
What's that?
I don't know. It's got a label, though. I'll read it. 11478 Mural Auditorium, right rear. Heroic struggle of the little guys to finish the mural.
That's ours, all right. I guess we got them red-handed.
Yeah, here's a red hand.
Listen, I'm just going to take... I'll take this along for evidence.
And hold it right there, boys!
Mr. Tirebiter!
Dad!
Dad, sir, to you, son. I'm People's Commissioner Tirebiter now, and nobody's sweetheart.
You must have won the election, Dad.
Right, son. Now I am the people. And the people, us, wants me to tell them it just what you're doing with your hands in number 35729, comma, shorts, comma, one pair blue gym, comma, W/protector worn by Barbara Bobo.
Oh, no!
I'd like to take one, too, Dad.
Scared, son? Don't be. I love you at times like this.
I know, Dad, but how can you be an... I mean, I still don't see how you can be my defense lawyer and the people's prosecutor all at the same time.
Easy, son. This way I can personally see that you're persecuted to the full extent of the laws.
That's my dad.
George Leroy Tirebiter, please take the stand.
Does he mean me?
Now stand tall, Porge. There's no...
You
This is a line of Indians leaving Rancho Malario to make room for you. Here's the beautiful Trail of Tears golf course.
This is Carolyn Presky. You've sold out. Now let's see just what you bought on this, your third day on Hawaiian Sellout. Bob, what's Miss Presky's heap so far?
Right, Jack. So far, a complete broken set of color bars for Mrs. B's new home, some leveled mountain skis and water rollers for that fun-filled open season, an unattached Grid 5 stand-up reheater with a smoke window, and now...
300 full pounds of Chef Antoine's Southern Fried Glimpse, toasted to gold perfection, cubed, reheated, and returned to water before you're ready, Miss B. And the inside, well, look at that. It's just as lovely. Two shelves were none are needed. And look at that. Close the door and the light stays on. Well, how do you feel, Miss Presky?
Sick.
Ah, well, you can afford it now, love. But like the good book says, there are bigger deals to come.
Was that the line you took, Lieutenant?
I can't.
Oh, go ahead. You have to answer this one.
I can't remember. I
told him
down,
my boy.
I can't remember.
Major, kindly instruct your client to stop acting, and you could take a couple of lessons in military toughness yourself.
Listen, everything went black.
General, I must insist this man is in no condition to replay that.
Well, I can see that, Major. Will the recording sergeant read the scene back to him?
Yes, sir. Alvarado, sir, what are we going to do, man? Matetsky, take it easy, Lieutenant. Tirebiter, we're going to go out there and cut. I can't say it. I'm sorry, but I zip, beep.
Can you remember now, Lieutenant?
Surrogate General Klein, sir. When I signed my contract with you, I fully intended to fulfill its terms with honor, sir. But you never told me I had to go out there and kill anybody.
Lieutenant, we will not tolerate the use of prohibited language in this courts-martials. The accursed will be advised of the absence of his rights under the secret code of military toughness and will act accordingly.
Oh, gee whiz. Sorry?
I suppose it's we parents should be sorry, Judge. We failed somewhere. We didn't raise this boy to use language like that.
That's not our fault anymore, Mr. Prosecutor. Call the next witness.
What do you think I ought to call him, Judge?
I don't know. We don't have a name for him. He never went to school.
Well, then, the people calls to the stand. You!
Don't point at me, Daddy.
No. You, the second man from the rear over there. You, the man with no shoes.
Who? Me?
You.
Mudhead? Oh, golly, yeah.
You promise to covet property, propriety, plurality, surety, security, and not hurt the state? Say what?
What?
Take your stand.
Now then, Mr. Head.
Hi, Mr. Tirebiter. You know me.
Do you know the defendant?
Do I know Porgy?
And you spend all your free time with him?
Sure, except when he's in school.
So you don't go to school?
Heck no. I'm 30 years old.
But you were in school, weren't you?
Never.
And with your friend Porgy?
No.
Last night.
Oh, you mean commie martyrs.
Communist martyrs high school, exactly.
Well, yeah, of course, Porgy had to find out where they were hiding more science, or he couldn't get out.
Or he couldn't get out. He admits it, he was trying to get out.
Isn't everybody?
Yes, to get out in times of declared emergency.
What emergency?
Well, there you are, Judge Poop. Youth here doesn't seem to know about the disappearance of the old school.
But that's what Porgy was looking for.
If you don't answer the question, young man, we're going to have to gag you.
What question?
Gag him.
Who was that lady I saw you with last night?
Oh, that was no lady. That was Bottles.
Bottles? I got so I'd drink anything. After that, I just couldn't seem to get off this stuff. My whole career went up in smoke. There was no way I could follow the scenario written by the people who pay for your wheelchairs, General.
Are you impugning, sir, that this uniform might be for sale? This uniform that bears the three stars that indicate my ratings? Bedecked with ribbons that represents every theater of war? Who wore it last in our proud company? This full dress uniform, W-2565, seen in our finest hours, in ruthless combat, in dogfights over Broadway, and worn out, finally, here on this spot, in parallel hell. What is it worth? How much do I hear?
That's metaphysically absurd, man. How could I know what you hear?
I don't hear that.
$5.
I heard that. What do you think you're trying to do, Lieutenant? Buy your way out of these proceedings?
I am out, Klein. I don't like you. I don't want a part in what you're selling. And I'm walking out of your set.
You can't do that.
Watch me.
You'll never work in this town again, Tirebiter.
What town?
George, come back. Now, don't worry, Mr. Klein. Don't get mad. I'll bring him back. He's a good boy. A good boy gone bad. You move when you're told not to move. You take off your shoes to evade the men who are trying to protect you. You sneak into a forbidden sector after curfew, and you are caught with your hands up something they don't belong. My, my, my! Your friends at Commie Martyrs must be mighty proud of you.
Dad, I don't have any friends at Commie Martyrs.
Hey, I've never even seen anyone from there.
You're right, Mudhead. And now there's no room for anybody because it's all filled up with more science.
Where'd they go?
Yeah, where did all the kids go?
Well, they're in Korea.
On which side?
What's that soldier doing in there? What do you mean by that?
What do you mean by that?
What do you mean by that?
I mean in whose movie?
This is no movie. This is real.
Which reel?
The last reel of this vintage motion picture, High School Madness. Lot number M-25, black and white, 35 millimeter.
Oh, I see.
Now, started at $5?
All right, let's I guess it was me.
25,
nice going, kid. See you later.
It's all a fake, Mudhead. They lied to me.
Hey, what do you mean, they?
You know, them.
Name three.
Well, there's the pooper and
you.
And me.
Hey, whose movie is this?
Yeah, it's nobody's now, Mudhead, because I'm getting out.
How are you going to do it, Porge?
I don't know.
How'd you get in here?
Oh, darn, I don't remember.
Well, where were you before?
Before?
Yeah.
Right. I sold out.
So here's your last deal, Miss Kresge. Now, which would you rather do? Hit this Jew over the head with a bag of sugar or beat out that rhythm on a drum?
Come on, love.
I'll take the bag.
You mean you're going to trade this 4-foot cube of 18-carat Swiss bullion and the snake knives, Mrs. Presky, all for that little bag?
Oh, yes, I want the bag.
Well, all right, then. Open it up.
Oh, what? Why, this is a bag of...
But it's really great, Mrs. Presky.
And so ends the Election Day special edition of New World Notes. Selections from Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers by the Fire Sign Theater. The message we heard from them is as important now, 42 years later, as ever. Reality is not the same as the cliches of film and TV, despite the best efforts of the establishment, including presidential candidates, despite their best efforts to persuade us otherwise. For pretty pictures, more information, and an archive of our shows, head over to newworldnotes.blogspot.com. For New World Notes, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, may the best man win, and when you get to the polling booth, consider writing in the name George Leroy Tirebiter. We could all do a lot worse, and probably will. Peace. We'll be right back.
hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocritics. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Last Saturday, I attended the conference at Middlesex Community College on how to stop the wars and prevent World War III. And the keynote speaker, Bahman Azad, an economics and sociology professor, stated that the banks are at the top of this system that perpetuates war. So I thought it was a good time to replay this show about the history of bankers and wars and assassinations. 9/11 was a false flag event carried out to rapidly move forward this agenda for the New World Order. So let's begin with this show about finances, bankers, war, and assassination. Today you're going to hear Michael Rivero, who does a radio show and website called WhatReallyHappened.com. He's going to be making the link between the bankers, wars, and presidential assassinations. While I don't agree with everything that Michael Rivero says on his website and radio show, I do think that this history of the bankers and wars is worth listening to. Every American should know this history. I was fascinated by it. You'll also find out how approximately 25% of America's land has been put up as collateral to foreign nations for our debt. So here he is, Michael Rivero, on a financial rant.
Now, I want to share a story with you, and this is actually an article that I wrote over the weekend called All Wars Are Bankers' Wars. And I went in, I did a lot of research, it's posted to the front page of WhatReallyHappened.com. I understand it's already gone viral, it's being reposted around the web. But I wanted to basically tell it to you here on the radio show. But it's something that you need to understand, that all of these wars and assassinations that we're told are crazed loan nut assassins, or weapons of mass destruction, or bringing democracy, all of them track back to the private central bankers as the initiating event. And the more you study this, the more you will realize all the wars are wars for the bankers, for the private central bankers. And I know a lot of people are going to have difficulty comprehending this, just how many of these wars we have fought as a nation were fought for no other purpose than to force private central banks onto nations that did not want them. So we're going to have a few examples so you understand why at this particular time in history the United States government is mired in so many wars against so many foreign nations. And there's plenty of precedents for this. Now, going back to the beginning, the United States fought the American Revolution primarily over King George III's Currency Act, which forced the colonists to abandon their own government-issued currencies and conduct business only using printed banknotes borrowed at interest from the Bank of England. If you go back to the writings of Ben Franklin, direct quote, "The refusal of King George III to allow the colonies to operate an honest money system, which freed the ordinary man from the clutches of the money manipulators, was probably the prime cause of the revolution." That's Ben Franklin. Now, our public schools don't teach that because you're not supposed to know that the bankers were really behind the American Revolution. After the revolution, the United States adopted a revolutionary, radically different economic system in which the government issued its own value-based currency so that private banks couldn't skim the wealth of the people through interest-bearing banknotes. So the American Revolution was fought primarily to free the American people from King George III's Currency Act, which ordered them to conduct all business using printed banknotes borrowed at interest from the Bank of England. So the Bank of England was just raking in wealth from the labor of the American people in exchange for ink and paper. And that fueled the anger that led to the American Revolution. Your public schools don't spend a lot of time on that, but that was really what it was all about. So the revolution was over, the United States was born, but the private bankers are nothing if not dedicated to their schemes to acquire other people's wealth, and they knew full well how easy it is to corrupt a nation's leaders. Now, just 1 year after Mayor Amschel Rothschild had uttered his infamous, "Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who makes the laws," private bankers succeeded in setting up a new private central bank called the First Bank of the United States, largely through the efforts of the Rothschilds' chief supporter in the United States, Alexander Hamilton. Now, this First Bank of the United States was founded in 1791 And by the end of its 20-year charter, the First Bank of the United States had almost ruined the nation's economy while enriching the bank's owners. As a result, Congress refused to renew the charter and signaled their intention to go back to a state-issued value-based currency on which the people paid no interest at all to any banker. This resulted in a threat from Nathan Mayer Rothschild against the U.S. government. Quote, "Either the application for renewal of the charter is granted, or the United States will find itself involved in a most disastrous war." End quote. Congress still refused to renew the charter for the First Bank of the United States, whereupon Nathan Mayer Rothschild railed, quote, "Teach those impudent Americans a lesson. Bring them back to colonial status." End quote. Financed by the Rothschild-controlled Bank of England, Britain then launched the War of 1812 to recolonize the United States and force them back into the slavery of the Bank of England's banknotes, or to plunge the United States into so much debt they would be forced to accept a new private central bank. And the plan worked. Even though the United States won the War of 1812, Congress was forced to grant a new charter for yet another private bank, issuing the public currency as loans at interest, the Second Bank of the United States. Once again, private bankers were in control of the nation's money supply and cared not who made the laws or how many British or American soldiers had to die for it. So once again, the nation was plunged into debt, unemployment, poverty by the predations of the private central bank, and in 1832, Andrew Jackson successfully campaigned for his second term as president under the slogan, "Jackson and No Bank." True to his word, Jackson succeeded in blocking the renewal of the charter for the Second Bank of the United States of America. And this was where that famous quote came from Andrew Jackson. Quote, "Gentlemen, I too have been a close observer of the doings of the Bank of the United States. I have had men watching you for a long time, and I am convinced that you've used the funds of the banks to speculate in the breadstuffs of the country. When you won, you divided the profits amongst you, and when you lost, you charged it to the bank. You tell me that if I take the deposits from the bank and annul the charter, I shall ruin 10,000 families. That may be true, gentlemen, but that is your sin. Should I let you go on, you will ruin 50,000 families, and that would be my sin. You are a den of vipers and thieves. I've determined to rout you out, and by the eternal God, I will rout you out." End quote. Andrew Jackson. Shortly after the charter for the Second Bank of the United States expired, there was an assassination attempt on Andrew Jackson, and it failed when both pistols used by the assassin, Richard Lawrence, failed to fire. Later on, Lawrence explained the motive for the assassination by saying that with President Jackson dead, money would be more plenty. So it was an assassination motivated by the interests of the bankers. Now, our public school system is as subservient to the bankers' wishes to keep certain history from you, just as the corporate media is subservient to Monsanto's wishes to keep the dangers of GMOs from you, and the global warming cult's wishes to conceal from you the fact that Earth has actually been cooling for the last 16 years. So it should probably be no surprise that the financial dimension of the Civil War are not well known to the average American. It's portrayed in our history books and our popular media as an internal dispute over slavery. But in fact, it was a war with global implications. When the Confederacy seceded from the United States, the bankers once again saw the opportunity for a rich harvest of debt and offered to fund Lincoln's efforts to bring the South back into the Union at 30% interest. Lincoln remarked that he would not free the black man by enslaving the white man to the bankers, and using his authority as president, issued a new government currency, the greenback. This was a direct threat to the wealth and power of the central bankers, who quickly responded. This is a quote from the London Times following Lincoln's issuance of the greenbacks. Quote, "If this mischievous financial policy, which has its origin in North America, shall become indurated down to a fixture, then that government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off debts and be without debt. It will have all the money necessary to carry on its commerce. It will become prosperous without precedent in the history of the world. The brains and wealth of all countries will go to North America. That country must be destroyed, or it will destroy every monarchy on the globe." So, goaded by the private bankers, much of Europe supported the Confederacy against the Union, with the expectation that victory over Lincoln would mean the end of the greenback. France and Britain seriously considered an outright invasion on the United States in support of the Confederacy, but they were held at bay by Russia. little bit of history most Americans don't understand. Russia came to the aid of Lincoln's Union during this crisis. Now, at that time, Russia had just ended their serfdom system, and they had a state central bank similar to the system the United States had been founded on. Now, free of European intervention, the Union won the war, and Lincoln announced his intention to go on issuing the greenbacks. Following Lincoln's assassination, the greenbacks were pulled from circulation and the American people forced to go back to an economy based on banknotes borrowed at interest from the private bankers. So finally, in 1913, the private central bankers of Europe, in particular the Rothschilds of Great Britain, the Warburgs of Germany, met with their American financial collaborators on Jekyll Island, Georgia, to form a new banking cartel with the express purpose of forming the Third Bank of the United States, with the aim of placing complete control of the United States money supply once again under the control of private bankers. Owing to hostility over the previous banks of the United States, the name of this third bank was changed to the Federal Reserve in order to grant the new bank a quasi-governmental image. But in fact, it is a privately owned bank. It's no more federal than Federal Express. In fact, last year, the Federal Reserve successfully rebuffed a Freedom of Information lawsuit by Bloomberg News on the grounds that as a private banking corporation and not actually a part of the U.S. government, the Freedom of Information Act did not apply to the operators of the Federal Reserve. So 1913 proved to be a transformative year for the nation's economy. First, with Congress' passage of the 16th Income Tax Amendment and the false claim it had been ratified. Here's another direct quote. I think if you were to go back and try and find and review the ratification for the 16th Amendment, which was the Internal Revenue, the income tax, I think if you went back and examined that carefully, you would find that a sufficient number of states never ratified that amendment, end quote. That's U.S. District Court Judge James C. Fox in Sullivan versus United States, 2003. Later that same year, 1913, and apparently unwilling to risk another questionable amendment, Congress passed the Federal Reserve Act over the Christmas holiday 1913, while members of Congress opposed to the measure were at home. This was a very underhanded deal, as the Constitution explicitly vests Congress with the authority to issue the public currency, does not authorize its delegation, and thus would have required a new amendment to transfer that authority to a private bank. But pass it, Congress did. And President Woodrow Wilson signed it as he promised the bankers he would in exchange for generous campaign contributions. Now, President Wilson later regretted that decision. You've probably heard this quote before, but you're going to get it again. Quote, I am a most unhappy man. I have unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is now controlled by its system of credit. We are no longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men. That was Woodrow Wilson writing in 1919. Now, 1 year after the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, World War I started. And it is important to remember that prior to the creation of the Federal Reserve, there was no such thing as a world war. Now, World War I actually started between Austria-Hungary and Serbia, but quickly shifted to focus on Germany. Why Germany? They didn't start the war. Why was Germany the villain in World War I? Well, the real reason was their industrial capacity was seen as an economic threat to Great Britain. Great Britain's pound was already in decline at the time because too much economic emphasis was on banking and finance, and not enough was on agricultural development, industrial development, and infrastructure. It's very much like the situation we have in the United States right now. All the financial operatives, they want to play the Wall Street games, and other parts of the economy are being neglected. We've lost a great deal of our manufacturing. We're not the agricultural exporter we used to be because everybody's over there at Wall Street playing in that giant open-air casino. Now, pre-war Germany did have a private central bank, but it was under strict control by the German government to keep inflation at reasonable levels and to make sure that all of the German economy was being properly funded, just like Putin did with their central bank about a month ago. Under government control, by the German government, investment was guaranteed to internal economic development, and as a result, Germany had become a major manufacturing technological power. They were exporting products that Great Britain could not compete with. So in the media of the day, Germany was portrayed as the main opponent of World War I. And not just defeated, it was flattened. Now, following the Treaty of Versailles, Germany was ordered to pay the war costs of all the participating nations, even though Germany had not started that war. This amounted to three times the value of all of Germany itself. Germany's private central bank to which the German government had gone deeply into debt to pay the cost of the wars, was allowed to break free of government control. That led to the massive inflation of the Weimar Republic, followed permanently trapping the German people in endless debt. And money speculators were running rampant, and it led to these situations where you had literally a whole basket full of paper notes to get a loaf of bread. Now, when the Weimar Republic collapsed economically, it opened the door for the National Socialists to take power. Their first financial move was to issue their own state currency, which was not borrowed from private central banks. It was based on a unit of value, not a unit of debt. Freed from having to pay interest on the money in circulation, Germany blossomed and quickly began to rebuild its industry. It was an amazing transformation to see. The media called it the German miracle. Time magazine lionized Hitler for the amazing improvement of life for the German people and the explosion of German industry, and they even named him Time magazine's Man of the Year in 1938. And then once again, Germany's prosperity and freedom from a private central bank loaning the public currency at interest became a threat to other nations and other powers. I have a couple of quotes here from Winston Churchill that tells you what was really going through the minds of Europe in the years leading up to World War II. Quote, should Germany merchandise again, which means do business, should Germany merchandise again in the next 50 years, we have led this war, World War I, in vain. That was Winston Churchill writing in the Times in 1919. Another quote, quote, we will force this war upon Hitler if he wants it or not, end quote. Winston Churchill in a 1936 radio broadcast. Quote, Germany becomes too powerful. We have to crush it. End quote. Winston Churchill in November 1936 speaking to U.S. General Robert Wood. Quote, this war is an English war, and its goal is the destruction of Germany. Winston Churchill, autumn 1939 broadcast. So it was all about economics and profitability. Now, Germany's state-issued value-based currency was also a direct threat to the wealth and power of the private central banks around the world. And as early as 1933, they started to organize a global boycott against Germany to strangle this upstart ruler who thought he could run his nation without a private central bank. Now, as had been the case in World War I, Great Britain and other nations threatened by Germany's economic power looked for an excuse to go to war. And as public anger in Germany grew over the boycott, Hitler foolishly gave them that excuse. Years later, in a spirit of candor, the real reasons for the war were made clear. Quote, the war wasn't only about abolishing fascism, but to conquer sales markets. We could have, if we had intended so, prevented this war from breaking out without doing one shot, but we didn't want to. End quote. Winston Churchill to Harry Truman, March 1946. One more quote here. Quote, Germany's unforgivable crime before World War II was its attempt to loosen its economy out of the world trade system and to build up an independent exchange system from which the world finance couldn't profit anymore. We butchered the wrong pig, end quote. Winston Churchill writing in his book, The Second World War. Now, a little side note, we're going to actually step back in time to the years before World War II. A little bit of history a lot of Americans are still completely unaware of. And it involves a gentleman by the name of Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler. In 1933, Wall Street bankers and financiers had bankrolled the successful rise to power of Hitler and Mussolini. Brown Brothers Harriman in New York, and they're still there. I saw them when I was there for the 9/11 anniversary. They were financing Hitler right up to the day war was declared with Germany. And these Wall Street financiers decided that a fascist dictatorship in the United States, based on the one Mussolini had in Italy, was going to be far better for their business interests than Roosevelt's New Deal, which threatened massive wealth redistribution to recapitalize the working and middle classes of America. So the Wall Street tycoons recruited General Butler to lead the overthrow of the U.S. government and install a Secretary of General Affairs, who would be answerable to Wall Street and not the people, would crush social unrest and shut down all the labor unions. General Butler pretended to go along with the scheme, but then exposed the plot to Congress. So they recruited Major General, Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler, to lead this coup d'etat, because Butler was very popular with the soldiers, and his image as part of this move would help convince the military this was the right thing to do. Now, to his credit, Major General Smedley Butler, remembering his oath to the Constitution, pretended to go along with the scheme, but then exposed the plot to the United States Congress. Congress, then as now, in the pocket of Wall Street bankers, refused to act. When Roosevelt learned of the planned coup, he demanded the arrest of the plotters, but the plotters simply reminded Roosevelt that if any one of them were sent to prison, their friends on Wall Street would deliberately collapse the still fragile U.S. economy and blame Roosevelt for it. So Roosevelt was unable to do anything about this attempted coup d'etat until the start of World War II, at which time he prosecuted many of the plotters under the Trading with the Enemy Act. Now, mostly it was glossed over, oh, it's just a rumor, unfounded, it's wacko conspiracy theory, but in 1967, the congressional minutes of Smedley Butler's revelation to Congress of the coup were finally released to the public. You ever see this movie, 7 Days in May, Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster, about an attempted military takeover of the United States of America? It was based loosely on this story. But of course, in the movie, the bankers being behind the Burt Lancaster character was completely removed from the script here. Now, Smedley Butler is also famous for writing a work called War is a Racket, and I would like to read you a quote from that. Quote, I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of our country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from second lieutenant to major general. And during that period, I spent more of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I suspected I was just part of a racket at the time. Now I'm sure of it. Like all members of the military profession, I never had an original thought until after I left the service. My mental faculties remained in suspended animation while I obeyed the orders of the higher-ups. This is typical with everyone in the military service. Thus, I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. The record of racketeering is long. I helped purify Nicaragua for the International Banking House of Brown Brothers in 1909 through 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China in 1927, I helped see to it that the Standard Oil went its way unmolested. During those years, I had, as the boys in the back room would say, a swell racket. I was rewarded with honors, medals, and promotion. Looking back on it, I feel I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was operate his racket in 3 city districts. I operated on 3 continents. General Smedley Butler, former U.S. Marine Corps commandant, and he wrote that in 1935. So, now moving forward here, as president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy understood the predatory nature of private central banking. He understood why Andrew Jackson fought so hard to end the Second Bank of the United States. So Kennedy wrote and signed Executive Order 11110, which ordered the U.S. Treasury to issue a new public currency called the United States Note. Now, Kennedy's United States notes were not borrowed from the Federal Reserve. They were created by the U.S. government and backed by the silver stockpiles held by the U.S. government. It represented a return to the system of economics the United States had been founded on, and it was perfectly legal for Kennedy to do so under the Constitution. All told, some $4.5 billion went into the public circulation, which eroded interest payments to the Federal Reserve and loosened their control over the nation. 5 months after signing Executive Order 11110, John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas, and the United States notes pulled from circulation and destroyed. Following Kennedy's assassination, John J. McCloy, president of the Chase Manhattan Bank and president of the World Bank, was named to the Warren Commission. Now, I don't care how good a banker he is. He's not qualified to be investigating a murder, which is what we were told the Warren Commission was all about, to get the truth of the assassination. But we all know that the Warren Commission was there to cover up what was going on. And obviously, we can presume safely that John J. McCloy's presence on the Warren Commission was to make sure the American public never got even a hint of the financial dimensions behind the assassination. So, as we enter the 11th year of what I am certain future history will most certainly describe as World War III, we need to examine the financial dimensions behind all these wars. Why are we here? Why are our children being killed and crippled? Is this another war for the profit of the private central bankers? And the answer is yes. Now, toward the end of World War II, when it became obvious that the Allies were going to win and dictate the post-war political environment, the major world economic powers met at Bretton Woods, a luxury resort in New Hampshire, in July of 1944, and they hammered out the Bretton Woods Agreement for International Finance. the British pound lost its position as the global trade and reserve currency to the U.S. dollar. There are indications this was part of the price demanded by Roosevelt in exchange for the U.S. entry into the war. Now, absent the economic advantages of being the world's go-to currency, Britain was forced to nationalize their Bank of England in 1946. The Bretton Woods Agreement, ratified in 1945, in addition to making the dollar the global reserve and trade currency, obligated the signatory nations to tie their currencies to the dollar. The nations that ratified Bretton Woods did so on two conditions. The first was that the Federal Reserve would refrain from overprinting the dollar, basically as a means to loot real products and produce from other nations in exchange for ink and paper. It basically was an imperial tax imposed by the U.S. economic system on the rest of the world. That assurance of no overprinting was supposedly backed up by the second requirement, which was that the U.S. dollar would always be convertible back to gold by the U.S. government at $35 an ounce. Now, of course, the Federal Reserve, being a private bank and not answerable to the U.S. government, did in fact start overprinting paper dollars, which were sent to other nations around the world, and under Bretton Woods, they had to send back products and produce and raw materials at full value. And much of the perceived American prosperity of the 1950s and 60s was the result of these foreign nations having to send real raw materials, goods, produce, back to the United States in exchange for these little pieces of paper with ink all over them, because they were forced to accept these paper notes as being worth $35 per ounce of gold. Then in 1970, France started looking at this huge pile of printed paper notes sitting in their bank vaults, for which real French products like wine and cheese had been traded, and it notified the United States government that they would exercise their option under Bretton Woods to return all those paper notes for gold at the agreed-upon $35 per ounce exchange rate. The problem was the United States had nowhere near the gold to redeem all those paper notes. So on August 15, 1971, Richard Nixon temporarily, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, say no more, suspended gold convertibility of the U.S. Federal Reserve notes. This Nixon shock, as it was termed at the time, effectively ended Bretton Woods, and many global currencies started to delink from the U.S. dollar. And it created another problem, because the United States had been collateralizing their loans, money borrowed from other governments and foreign investors, with the American nation's gold reserves. And with the awareness that there wasn't enough gold to redeem all the Federal Reserve notes, lenders to the U.S. were starting to wonder, did the U.S. government have enough gold to cover, collateralize their outstanding debts? Foreign nations began to get very nervous about the loans to the United States, and they were understandably reluctant to loan any additional money without some form of collateral. So what Richard Nixon did is he founded the environmental movement with the EPA and its various programs like wilderness zones and roadless areas and heritage rivers, wetlands, and all these other little different programs, which all took vast areas of public lands and made them off limits to the American people, who are technically the owner of all those lands. But Nixon had no concern for the environment, and the real purpose of this land grab, under the guise of the environment, was to pledge those pristine lands and their vast mineral resources as collateral on the outstanding national debt. The multitude of all these different programs was simply to conceal the scale of the land grab and collateralization of the American people's heritage. And it actually today covers almost 25% of the entire nation is now locked up by these EPA programs and pledged as collateral on government borrowing.
You've just been listening to the first of a two-part financial rant by Michael Rivero of the website whatreallyhappened.com. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of this fascinating financial timeline of bankers, backroom deals, wars, and assassinations. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
With Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
45 years ago, September 9th, 1971, prisoners took over Attica Prison in upstate New York to protest the prison conditions there. 4 days later, on the morning of September 13th, Governor Nelson Rockefeller ordered state troopers to storm the prison. Troopers shot indiscriminately over 2,000 rounds of ammunition. 39 men would die, prisoners and guards. After the shooting stopped, police beat and tortured scores more prisoners. 90 of the surviving prisoners were seriously wounded, but were initially denied medical care. After a quarter century of legal struggles, the state of New York would eventually award the surviving prisoners of Attica $12 million in damages. While not all events in history have something to say so directly, I think, to the present as does the Attica uprising. So an extended discussion with Heather Ann Thompson, author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Thank you for joining us, Heather.
It's great to be here.
The book is describing and relates to the material as though the Attica Rebellion is one of the most important civil rights struggles within the last century. I do want you to talk about that. If maybe you could get us then started with a brief passage from Blood in the Water.
There's no question that it's one of the most important civil rights struggles because imagine you have nearly 1,300 men from very different backgrounds and otherwise would have been divided on all kinds of differences of opinion, politically, religiously, but they all stood together on a very grim day when they decided that it was time to stand up against the inhumane conditions within the prison at Attica State. That moment, when they did that, they hit the world stage because the media was there, the world was watching, there were observers there to help them negotiate with the state. In that 4 days, the world got to see what prisons look like, and the world got to see why it would be that prisoners were human beings deserving of basic human rights. So this was a protest that was of probably the society's most marginalized citizens, broadcast across the world.
Every word in this book is so salient, so driven and important. Get us started by a passage of your choosing.
I think what I might do is share with you a passage when the retaking actually begins to really drive home what that moment was like and why it was so important to figure out what exactly law enforcement had done in this moment. This passage is describing actually two people, one of them named Mike Smith, who was a white guard at Attica, one who was quite liked by the prisoners because he had supported their earlier attempts to get better conditions by working through the system and writing letters. And it's him and a prisoner by the name of Don Noble, who was very instrumental in penning the manifesto at Attica to make clear what the demands were. They had worked together at Attica, and Don Noble had actually helped to protect Mike Smith in the very initial moments of the rebellion. But at the end of the day, as the state is about ready to come in, they are both up on the catwalk, and Mike Smith is blindfolded. Don Noble is one of the prisoners around him. The hope is that the state will think twice before coming in. The message they're trying to send is that if they come in with guns blazing, they will kill their own hostages. And this is at the moment when the shooting starts after the gas has dropped. Mike Smith felt the impact of the prisoner on his right being shot twice, the last shot literally catapulting him over the railing of the catwalk. In a futile attempt to save both himself and Mike from being hit, Don Noble pulled him to the left as the man immediately behind him received a fatal volley of gunfire. But the shots reached them anyway. Mike's abdomen was on fire as four bullets ripped across in a straight line. He was also shot in the arm, which felt as if it had been torn from his body. The bullets that entered Mike's stomach, dead center, right between his navel and genitals, exploded upon impact, which sent shrapnel downward to his spine. One exiting slug took the base of Mike's spine along with it, leaving a hole the size of a grapefruit in his intestines. All Mike could hear around him as the shooting kept going on and on was people crying, people dying, people screaming. As he lay curled up, bleeding profusely, Mike suddenly found himself looking up into the eyes of a trooper who had a shotgun pointed directly at his head. Somewhere close by, he heard a correction officer yell to the trooper, "He's one of us."
Wow, I'm just catching my breath. And I have to then ask you, because it struck me, maybe because I got to know him so well, what happened to Frank Big Black Smith? I will tell you that the last time I saw him before his passing, one of the most gentle, thoughtful, loving men who went on to work with attorney Elizabeth Fink. I was walking with him in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, to an event. And there wasn't a single street corner or store that he passed that people didn't come out to greet him, to offer their solicitations. This was a man of the people and one of the people in Attica. And tell us what happened to Frank Big Black Smith after taking of the prison, to give another dimension to the brutality that saw no limit.
Well, one of the striking things about Big Black was that he was a guy at Attica minding his own business, doing his time, not actually one of the more political guys in the yard. The treatment that he received at the hands of the state was cataclysmic, life-changing. The state, after having created so much bloodshed, really a massacre at Attica, stands out in front of the prison and says to the world that the prisoners have killed the hostages, which was not true, and worse, that one of them had actually castrated a guard. That guy who was accused of castrating a guard, incidentally, the guard Mike Smith, who had been shot by a fellow corrections officer, was Big Black. And the result of that lie told before the world was that he was tortured for hours and hours and hours. They placed a football under his neck, laid him on his back naked, and threatened him that they would kill him should this football drop from his neck, and dropped hot shells on him and kicked him and beat him. And he was so traumatized by that experience that it's actually Big Black who will lead the 30-year fight to have some degree of justice with the state of New York.
Let's go back to a description of the contours of the conditions that sparked the rebellion. And I know from your writing there was a specific incident to frame more of discussion about why these men rose up at Attica.
These were men who were being fed on 63 cents a day. They had 2 quarts of water in their cell. They were meant to bathe in that and wash their clothes in that and keep their cell clean from that. These were men who would get parole but could never get out because they had this crazy rule where you had to have a job when you got out, but in order to get a job, you would be handed this antiquated phone book and told to write employers. And until the employer said he would hire you, you couldn't get out of prison. So, you know, the minor and the major indignities and injustices, not speaking the language of many of the prisoners, Spanish, not being able to observe your religion if you were a Muslim. The medical care was horrendous. So these guys first wrote to their state senators and they begged for some sort of restitution through the system and got nowhere. Attica jumps off not because it was some massively planned conspiracy, as Rockefeller had imagined. It happens because of deep frustration that being heard was only going to happen through direct action. Although, ironically, the rebellion happens at first out of a complete decision on the part of management. There had been an altercation in the yard one night, and management decided in retaliation to lock these guys in a tunnel, not let them out to the rec yard, but they didn't tell the guards that they were going to do this either. There was terrible labor management relations in Attica as well, and everyone panics. So in this initial moment, it's a riot. People are panicking. They are trying to get free of one another and trying to run for cover, but that quickly morphs into a rebellion when the guys realize that they've all of a sudden been handed this opportunity to move into one space, which is D Yard, and to tell the world how they lived and what they needed, and to ask for observers to come and help them negotiate with the state. And thus began really one of the most remarkable, again, human rights and civil rights protests that we've seen in this country.
You found a cache of boxes in a Buffalo, New York courthouse in 2006, which included documents that had never before been made public. I want you to tell us about those. The struggle of Attica is about a struggle, what happened during those 4 days. It's a struggle about the continuing conditions, but it is a struggle about state cover-up.
So my question was, why is it, did law enforcement not ever take responsibility for what it did at Attica? Well, the answer was in those documents. I think everyone had known that was close to Attica that there had been some form of cover-up. It's very clear to me as I began to dig that not only did the state police, first of all, the state police were allowed to investigate the Attica uprising. The same people who had retaken Attica and committed so much trauma were allowed to investigate it, quote unquote, for the state. There was evidence missing. There was evidence tampered with, literally destroyed, and shooters were allowed to retire rather than face potential criminal indictment. The governor himself met with the heads of the state police, again, the same people who could possibly be indicted, who had launched the retaking, at his pool house with top state officials, to, in effect, get their story straight. What had gone wrong and what was the state's position going to be on this? And the upshot of all of this was that, in fact, even though no members of law enforcement were ever indicted, the state had a tremendous amount of evidence that it could have moved on, that it could have brought indictments, that it could have, in fact, made the story of Attica public and made clear who had created the real trauma there. My book is about that. And it's also about the incredible defense effort that the prisoners had to wage to defend themselves against the state's attempt to blame all of this on them rather than on law enforcement. It indicted 62 prisoners and tried to collectively give out numerous life sentences and so forth to people whom it essentially it had framed in the attempt to shift the blame from law enforcement over to the prisoners.
So this would seem to be another example of the fact that the lives of the citizenry of this country are not valued, are not protected by any means in the same way that people who are part of the incarceration nation would be, and that the state spent inordinate amounts of time and money, no doubt, the Rockefeller administration certainly, and subsequent administrations, am I not correct in that, in really covering up, in hiding, in burying the truth of the brutalization, indeed murders, that people should have been indicted for. So it seems to me what you're saying in the book is there are
people on the ground, from the policing apparatus, the enforcement apparatus that should have been indicted, and that indeed culpability rests with people in the governor's staff administration from Rockefeller forward.
Well, exactly. And I think that readers of this book will be a bit stunned at the way in which everybody that had power in this story, everybody from the lowest level clerk in a workman's compensation office up through judges and commissions and committees, up to the governor's office and those politicians, up to the White House, indeed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Throughout this story, there's multiple opportunities for people with power to have helped these guys and to have heard them and to have recognized that they had indeed been tortured and they had indeed been traumatized by that retaking. But at every step, people punted on that responsibility and indeed passed the buck, if not actively tried to shield their own from prosecution. And so it's a damning story on the one hand of, as you say, disregard for the lives of people who are behind bars, but it's actually even a bigger story than that. The hostages were treated abysmally by the state. They were swindled out of their workman's compensation. We had hostage wives, widows, who were approached by the state and handed meager checks in the mere hours after the rebellion, and told to just, you know, let this tide them over, to, you know, feed their many children. And in fact, they were swindled. They had elected a remedy under the state of New York by cashing those checks to never sue the state. That was actively done to them. So this is a story, in some respects, it's this David and Goliath story of these people, marginalized people, both these working class guards and also these prisoners who were all expendable. And yet don't go away. They spend 40 years trying to tell their story. That's why the book is long, because it is a long story. Indeed, today they still are fighting to have the Attica records released, and we have a right to that history. So the first step is that the state needs to open the records. But perhaps more importantly, what the survivors would say categorically is the state needs to take responsibility for this level of, again, trauma and harm that it did back in 1971. The trauma still from that event is palpable. So many people that I talked to for this book broke down remembering that moment. Entire families were destroyed. So one of the things that has been bandied about, certainly by the hostages, has been this idea of some form of truth and reconciliation, a moment when it's really clear who did what, when, so that there can be healing.
Attica's walls are really an affront to humanity, and nothing short of closing the prison will end them. The harrowing...
Well,
no, go ahead.
We're in a far worse position than we were even back in 1971. Prisons are far more overcrowded. The conditions are far worse. Indeed, the folks on the inside are still a group of people who the society imagines to be the worst of the worst, but in fact are a completely mixed group of people. Just, you know, back in 71, there were 19-year-olds in there on parole violations. There were drug addicts. There were people who needed help rather than harm, and that still is true. And yes, there are people who are who have committed severe harm themselves. But Attica is today one of the most abusive prisons we have in the nation. Today, we still hear stories of severe abuse of prisoners, the most recent one being a guy named George Williams, who tried valiantly to take his case to the courts and have the guards who harmed him prosecuted, again, not particularly successfully. So Attica today is an affront. And so that's why there is today this call to finally close Attica, because the inhumanity still exists there.
We touched on it a little, but one of the things is that it's so deeply relevant today because we don't have the equal protection under the law that law enforcement has. 40 years
That's
to
right.
protect the police. There's a different standard, and that should mean everything to those of good conscience as they recount and look through your interviews and your transcripts and other documents that covered 35 years of the reluctancy of these government agencies to render any justice to the process of the inhumanity that occurred at Attica.
From a historical point of view, this book will certainly tell stories that they've not heard and take them back there. But as I hope that it also makes us very circumspect about today. I think today, particularly after events in Ferguson or Baltimore or Chicago, you know, the nation looks and says, well, you know, law enforcement is not indicted, and so therefore there must have been no evidence. Or in rare cases where law enforcement is indicted, such as in Baltimore, well, law enforcement does not get convicted, so therefore they must not have had any wrongdoing. One of the things that the Attica story very graphically displays is that just because someone has not been indicted or just because someone has not been convicted does not at all mean that there was not a crime committed. It does not at all mean that injustices were not done, because you can quickly see the level of protection that the police are afforded at every level, despite the fact that they say that they feel unprotected by the law. At every level in the Attica story, it was very clear that law enforcement was not going to have the same scope of justice trained on it that the prisoners did. Even for the hostages who would, you know, having been guards, were sort of part of law enforcement, it was a real wake-up call to see that those who spoke out against injustice were shunned and were very much left out of that compact, that law enforcement compact.
Inmates were folks who knew about the Soledad brothers and George Jackson and the Black Panther Party. There was a profundity of knowledge and information that surged through these brothers' experiences, certainly informed their negotiations and navigations within the yard when they took the prison. So I'd like you to talk more about who these people were and the kind of structure that humanizes them and gives them, I think, heroic proportions.
In this book, you are taken into places like the yard where you see that these are a group of men who are desperately trying to get an education, to read, to think, and that even in the moments of most intense fear and conflict while this rebellion goes on, they are surrounding the hostages to make sure that they are protected. They're giving them the mattresses and the food when other people might not have the same. They are protecting one another. And the kind of overwhelming sense you get is that these are people who've thought long and hard about these questions of humanity and injustice. And this all came out in the negotiations. This all came out in the sophistication that went into thinking through what is it that we really need to survive this place. And those things were quite basic. You know, nearly 1,300 men stood together, many of whom were not particularly political, but they could see that this was, again, a basic human rights struggle. So it was, really a remarkable organization of human beings that I hope will upend what people imagine goes on behind bars.
45 years after Attica, the waves of change are slowly creeping into the public discourse. The inmates themselves are on organizing a national strike to build into a single tidal shift the American prison system. They hope to end prison slavery by making it impossible by refusing to be slaves any longer. And really, that was the cry at Attica. It was about the conditions, but it was about the humanity human beings. And I wonder about your thoughts of how Attica and the legacy of Attica informing this prisoner strike and look to shut down Attica among other prisons throughout the country.
Well, I think the line is direct, and it took me 13 years to write this book, again, from the difficulty of finding the records. But over the course of those 13 years, a lot has changed. The bulk of that time, we were in the midst of the biggest prison buildup in American history. We came to be the country that locked up more people than any other country on the globe, treating all kinds of social ills via the criminal justice system rather than through the public health system or the education system. And by the time the book was finished, we had reached a sufficient crisis point in our prison system of overcrowding and terrible conditions, a lot of discontent coming both out of prisons and outside of prisons, people speaking out about so many of their loved ones having been ensnared in the system, that we are now at a moment where people are rethinking this. So whereas for the last 40 years, Attica to many represented backlash. In other words, Attica became the excuse because of the lies the state told about who had created the most harm there. The nation thought Attica was a rationale for being more punitive. Attica was the reason to get tougher on crime. Now, Attica once again is resonating as a message of reform and rebellion, that we need to look back to that moment 45 years ago when people stood together and said, yes, we are behind these walls, but we are still people, and we will stand together. And so notably, across the nation, as we sit on the eve of this anniversary, Attica is very much on the minds, I think, of incarcerated folks and their families on the outside, but on the minds of the nation.
And I wonder if you can take us out with a reading from the epilogue of Blood in the Water, the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its legacy.
The Attica Uprising of 1971 happened because ordinary men, poor men, disfranchised men, and men of color had simply had enough of being treated as less than human. That desire in their fight is by far Attica's most important legacy. That those who have endured Attica have always insisted on speaking out is something that matters. As this book goes to press, vital materials at the New York State Archives remain closed to the public. State officials are still denying Freedom of Information requests, even though there's no legal rationale to do so. Even the Attica documents that filled the shelves of the Erie County Courthouse in 2006 that I happened upon have since disappeared. But despite state officials' continued efforts to put every roadblock imaginable in the way of journalists, historians, and filmmakers, they have not stopped Attica's history from being written, nor Attica's survivors from telling their story. From New York in 1971, when nearly 1,300 prisoners stood up against overcrowding and the myriad other injustices that had become policy, to California in 2013, when 30,000 prisoners launched a hunger strike against the repressive conditions there, to Texas in 2015, when prisoners shut down a major penal facility because of serious abuses, America's incarcerated people have never stopped struggling against this country's worst and most punitive practices. The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 shows the nation that even the most marginalized citizens will never stop fighting to be treated as human beings. It testifies to this irrepressible demand for justice. This is Attica's legacy.
Heather Ann Thompson's prophetic analysis is a sobering reminder that we must all care about what is happening to human beings behind prison walls. Really get this book, one of the most important civil rights struggle of the last century. I want to thank you so much for joining us and for writing this book. Praise indeed is due. Blood in the Water with the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its legacy, and we have been speaking with Heather Ann Thompson.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
We all were challenged to think about how women were experiencing things, how immigrants were experiencing this hate.
I, like so many other people, had this sucker punch because we wound up with Donald Trump.
I know.
How the hell did that happen?
I hate to say that Donald Trump unified us in that way.
Whatever it takes.
If we are a movement about love, saying good morning without the disrespect, without the hatred, is kind of disarming in some ways.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Israel's chief rabbi calls for homosexual executions, gay arrests alarm activists in the Ivory Coast and Turkey, and it's the dawn of the Donald.
Believe me.
Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending November 19, 2016. Israel's chief rabbi, Shlomo Amar, told the newspaper Israel Hayom this week that Jewish law requires what he called the cult of abomination, homosexuality, to be punished by execution. He described same-gender sexual attraction as a lust, as with any other kind of lust, that could and should be resisted. Rabbi Amar is the leader of the Sephardic Jewish community in Jerusalem, for which he receives an Israeli government paycheck. He previously called the Holy City's annual LGBT Pride Parade an embarrassing phenomenon and condemned the parade's desecration of God's name in Jerusalem. Several members of parliament have written to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to complain about the rabbi's most recent comments. Three wrote a joint letter demanding that a public figure that puts Israeli citizens' life at risk using incitement and exclusion should be immediately fired. Opposition Meretz party leader Zahava Galon wrote on her Facebook page that Rabbi Amar can cover himself in the Torah as much as he wants, but we hear his darkness, not the Torah. The time has come to stop paying for his salary.
The BBC reported that Israeli LGBT activist Shirley Kleinman has filed a formal complaint with the police, accusing Rabbi Amar of incitement to murder. As she wrote on her Facebook page, "Let's try and ensure that this man will not remain in his key public position." Israel Hayom itself reported that another complaint charging incitement has been filed by Oded Fried, formerly the head of the nation's leading LGBT advocacy group, Agudah. "I call on law enforcement and elected officials who hold the power to act without delay," he told the newspaper, "to prosecute to the full extent of the law anyone who calls for harming people on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity."
Two men were each given 3-month prison sentences for public indecency in the Ivory Coast earlier this month. Gay sex is not against the law in the West African nation, but public indecency is. Despite its reputation as a relatively tolerant place in Africa for LGBT people, homophobia runs deep in the country's culture. Ahmad ransacked the Abidjan headquarters of Alternative Côte d'Ivoire, a leading national LGBT rights organization, in January 2014. Several gay men were reportedly attacked and forced to flee their homes in June after a U.S. embassy picture circulated in social media showing them signing a condolence book for the 49 people killed in Orlando's LGBT Pulse nightclub massacre. Frank Amani, advocacy director for Espace Confiance, a group that provides health services to sexual minorities, told the Associated Press this week that it's the first known case of gay men being prosecuted under the country's public indecency statutes. He said the two men, aged 31 and 19, denied having a sexual relationship. "We are revolted by what is happening," Amani said, "and by the judgment that was given."
A Turkish LGBT rights activist and lawyer was arrested this week in Istanbul, along with other members of his HDP political party, as part of an ongoing crackdown on dissent by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Levant Pishkin was arrested at his apartment in the early morning hours of November 14th, soon after he visited the imprisoned leader of his pro-Kurdish HDP, who was jailed last week. The HDP is the only major political party in Turkey with pro-LGBT policies. Some of Pishkin's belongings were also confiscated, including his computer and phone. Over the past few years, according to a report in the English-language Armenian Mirror Spectator, the high-profile human rights activist and attorney has suffered constant harassment. A bomb attributed to Turkish nationalists recently went off in his garden. President Erdogan sued him in March 2014 for insult, slander, or heavy provocation of a public official for their public service, for which he was fined the equivalent of $3,700. The Observatory for the Protection of Human Rights Defenders, a partnership of international rights groups Pishkin has represented, announced on November 16th that he'd been provisionally released pending the end of the investigation. He has yet to be charged with a crime.
In other news, organizers of the annual Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras Parade have let it be known that Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is no longer welcome. He became the first sitting Australian PM to attend the parade earlier this year, though he didn't march in it, but he won't be invited back in 2017. The disinvitation was approved this week at the annual general meeting of the Mardi Gras Board via a motion offered by Kat Rose of Community Action Against Homophobia. LGBT activists have condemned both Turnbull's failed marriage equality plebiscite and his gutting of the Queer Supportive Australian Safe Schools program. He announced soon after the plebiscite proposal failed in Parliament that his governing coalition has no plans to address the issue of marriage equality, at least in the near future. "We wanted to express our disgust at his prime ministership as a community," Rose said, "and to say that we don't need his phony friendship." The official motion reads, "The annual general meeting of Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras does not believe that a prime minister who denies us equality should be welcome as an official guest at our parade." Twitter has been percolating with both pro and con reactions. Some thank the board, while others call the declaration counterproductive, petty, or small-minded. The Guardian newspaper noted that the vote was non-binding.
Elsewhere, jailed transgender U.S. Army private Chelsea Manning is hoping President Barack Obama will commute her 35-year prison sentence before he leaves office. The whistleblower, considered a patriot by some and a traitor by others, was responsible for the greatest leak of intelligence material in U.S. history, some of it disclosing unprosecuted war crimes by the American military in Iraq. She tweeted this week that, "I ask POTUS for time served, a first chance to live out of prison as a woman." Manning has attempted suicide twice since July. The first came out of a deepening depression over being in a male military prison and not being allowed to present as female. The second attempt took place last month while she was being punished by solitary confinement for the first suicide attempt. Manning's supporters have launched a petition that asks for her release. It says, "Chelsea is a woman in a men's facility facing ongoing mistreatment. Her life is at risk and you can save her." The petition at whitehouse.gov also claims that Chelsea has already served more time in prison than any individual in United States history who disclosed information in the public interest. Her disclosures harmed no one. The petition needs 99,999 signatures by December 14th to get a response from the White House.
Ellen DeGeneres has received many accolades in her life, starting with her brilliantly brave coming out in real life and as a lead character on her TV sitcom in 1997. She's hosted the Academy Awards twice, along with other national award shows, all to great reviews, and has ruled U.S. daytime TV since 2003 with her multi-Emmy-winning talk and entertainment show, Ellen. And on November 22nd, she'll be awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom at a White House ceremony by Barack Obama himself, the last chance he'll get to host the event as president. It's the highest civilian honor a person can receive in the United States, and is presented to individuals who have made especially meritorious contributions to the security or national interest of the United States, to world peace, or to cultural or other significant public or private endeavors. DeGeneres joins 20 other distinguished honorees, including Diana Ross, Robert De Niro, Lorne Michaels, Cicely Tyson, Tom Hanks, Bruce Springsteen, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Robert Redford.
And finally, Boston-based True Colors Out Youth Theater, the nation's longest-running queer youth theater group, received the National Arts and Humanities Youth Program Award this week from First Lady Michelle Obama. As The Advocate reported, it was one of 12 honorees and the first LGBT organization to be so honored. Abe Rybeck is Executive Artistic Director of Theater Offensive, founded in 1989, which created True Colors, not connected with Cyndi Lauper's charity of the same name, in 1994. Ryback told the news magazine that, "When we started doing this, using the words queer theater company and youth in the same sentence made people bristle. Now we have a chance to get a hug from a first lady who has done more for our community than any other first lady. It's hard to imagine," he added, "what the White House atmosphere will be like for the groups that win this award next year."
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 19th, 2016, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
You're listening to This Way Out, brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters, featuring queer history, LGBT music, and behind-the-scenes looks at relevant movies and TV shows. You can also now get CDs of our regular program by subscription, and be sure you never miss a week of This Way Out. For all the details, please visit our website at thiswayout.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States, Donald Trump!
It's hard to figure out whether one is watching a Bizarro World version of The Apprentice or The Bachelorette. Then you remember that this really is the first week of the transition into power of U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. As Trump holds auditions for staff and cabinet positions, the LGBTQ community already has deep concerns about three announced appointments. Former Breitbart news editor and fringe right champion Steve Bannon as the president's chief strategist and senior advisor, former segregationist and confirmed homophobe Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions as his attorney general, and retired and discredited Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn as his national security advisor. The name of vehemently anti-queer William H. Pryor Jr., who's called for gay people to be jailed, has been floated as a possible Trump pick for the Supreme Court. The most painful result of the election returns, however, has been the dramatic rise in hate-related incidents, from pro-Trump graffiti on vandalized black churches to swastikas on the dorm rooms of Jewish college students to an increase in the already horrific harassment and violence against transgender people. The Southern Poverty Law Center reports over 700 incidents since 11/9. Meanwhile, San Francisco's public school teachers have been offered a classroom lesson plan to help one of the most diverse student populations in the country deal with post-election anxieties. The Associated Press reports that social studies teacher Fakra Shah wrote it for her own classes and didn't expect it to be sent by the teachers' union to its more than 6,000 members. Local Republican officials have vehemently condemned it, but a district spokesperson said only that the lesson plan is optional and not part of the official curriculum. It doesn't mince words. "Let us please not sidestep the fact," part of the plan's introduction reads, "that a racist and sexist man has become the president of our country by pandering to a huge racist and sexist base. We can uplift ourselves and fight oppression here at school, even if we cannot control the rest of the country."
Brace for impact. What does the Trump victory mean, and where do we go from here?
For This Way Out,
I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Michelangelo Signorelli is a well-known activist, a serious radio show host, and author of the painfully timely titled book, It's Not Over, Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality. And he joins us by phone from New York City. All I could really come up with as an opening question was, how do we keep our heads from exploding?
I think that grieving, which I think a lot of people have been doing, is very important. But I think it's time to really pull out of that and get fired up and really fight. And I think that keeps you going. I think that keeps you focused and realizing that there's another day.
I think a lot of us do feel that way. Okay, I'm going to do something, but we're so used to doing things from the privacy of our, you know, telephones and computer terminals that we're kind of at a loss for what would actually be the best use of our energies. And what are your thoughts about that?
I think the protests have been amazing. I mean, for a time in which, as you just said, people are so used to being online and doing activism there, to see these numbers of people in the streets across the country has really been invigorating. And I think it's important for people to get out and do it. And it's not contesting the election or saying it was rigged or anything like that. It's people saying, this was not a normal election. It was a hate campaign. We cannot tolerate that. I think it's so important that Donald Trump and the Republicans know that people will mobilize very quickly and that we will be a force. And I hope what comes out of the protests is also a movement that goes into politics, that creates candidates and really helps to challenge the Republican Party in the way the Tea Party did with President Obama, although they were kind of an AstroTurf-created movement. This is a real movement of people on the streets, and I think it really can become something big.
How long, though, doesn't the people on the streets thing have a certain lifespan? I mean, you can't flood the streets with protesting people every other week, can you? Can you?
Well, I think you might have to. It really depends on what we see moving forward. People probably will, I hope, start getting together. And I've been reading some accounts of getting together and sort of trying to create something else out of this movement that's grown on the streets. But as I said, is more political. But I think once they see something, like, for instance, the naming of Bannon, Steve Bannon, as a White House aide, or if we see any movement on immigration or LGBT rights or anything that is detrimental, I think people really need to be able to get back in the streets again. I think it really does show a force.
Is it me, or are we seeing perhaps a little late in the game this concept of intersectionality that has kind of existed in very political circles and in academia kind of coming to fruition? Like, people are seeing that it kind of doesn't matter what your personal issue is. We're sort of all in it together. Am I being kind of naive and optimistic about that?
No, I think that's true. I hate to say that Donald Trump unified us in that way.
Whatever it takes.
But it certainly is true, because I think we all were challenged to think about how others were experiencing things, how women were experiencing things, how immigrants were experiencing this hate. It just, everybody was challenged to think about it and to think about people for whom it does intersect in that way, and for whom, you know, they are threatened in a variety of ways. And I think now that we see the hate that is being generated, we see that the hate is also equal opportunity. LGBT people are being attacked on the streets. You know, even though Donald Trump didn't make such hateful pronouncements, the people who are attacking Latinos and African Americans and yelling white power, they're attacking queer people as well. Donald Trump puts on a show. And the show he's putting on about LGBT rights has been that he says the words, he said the term LGBTQ, he even said on 60 Minutes, oh, marriage is settled. Of course, it's as settled as any of the judges he puts on the Supreme Court think it is, and every one of them is an extremist that will, he believes, overturn Roe v. Wade, so I don't know how they wouldn't overturn marriage. He's trying to put out this idea that he
is somehow somewhat pro-LGBT. We have to dismantle that. Mike Pence is set to be the most powerful vice president in history, and that's according to what Donald Trump's campaign has said throughout. And now he's running the transition team and stacking the transition team on domestic policy issues with anti-LGBT activists. And, you know, it's all the little things. People should forget marriage equality. It's like a trap that people get stuck in. It would take years on putting two people on the Supreme Court to overturn marriage equality. But in the meantime, they can make same-sex marriage a second-class kind of marriage. They can pass the First Amendment Defense Act, which allows for clerks like Kim Davis to turn away gay couples.
Just like what's happened to the abortion rights since Roe v. Wade.
That's right. And it's all the other stuff that the Obama administration has put in place throughout all the agencies, anti-bullying programs in schools that are funded by the federal government, health programs for LGBT people funded by the federal government, the transgender student directive to the schools. Mike Pence already said that was going to be dismantled, that they would defer to the states. The federal government shouldn't be telling the schools what to do. All of those agencies, Health and Human Services Department, Education Department, so many programs will be defunded while Donald Trump still goes on talk shows and says LGBTQ. So we have to focus in on that and expose that scam. As I wrote in my book, and as the title says, right, you have to live in the world of It's Not Over. Civil rights activists have had to live in that world. African Americans have had to live in that world since slavery. There are people who have struggled far more than we have. It's never really over because you're always defending rights when you're a minority or a marginalized group like women. You have to constantly live in the fight, and you have to constantly be on guard. And as I say, and it's not over, guard against victory blindness. There's this idea that someday it's all done. One day it's all done. You win these set of rights and it's all finished. And the moment that happens, it's gone. So I think you have to just reconfigure your life to live in the fight.
Michelangelo Signorelli is a well-known activist, a serious radio show host, and author.
Hi, I'm Cleve Jones, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. An informed community is a strong community.
There's got to be a morning after if we can hold on through the night. Chance to find the sunshine. Let's keep on looking for the light.
I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
We have one very smart woman with us, Karen Oakham, who is an award-winning Los Angeles area journalist. You've been covering LGBT issues for so long.
What struck me the most, because I've talked to Michelangelo about this, was his comments about victory blindness in the context of an ongoing civil rights struggle. So what came to my mind was keep your eye on the prize, because, you know, that's been true for the African-American struggle, for the Latino struggle, on and on and on. And it's true for us as well. I, like so many other people, you know, had this sucker punch. You know, I was so stunned and surprised because I expected one outcome and we wound up with Donald Trump.
I know.
How the hell did that happen?
I've heard other people refer to this. They say it waking up or going to sleep Tuesday night, it felt like a death in the family. And I'm thinking, I've had family members die, and you're prepared for that. It's a natural process, and you get
There's
over
some
this.
Rules for how to deal with that
yeah,
in a weird
like
way.
Yeah, this is like every single day you're going to be reminded it happened.
Well, you know, think about actually how far we have come. I mean, you know, in the 50s where, you know, so many of these religious right people want to take us back to, that's make America great again. That's what they're thinking.
It wasn't that great. I was there.
Well, but you know, we had lobotomies, you know, incarceration. I mean, that's what Stonewall was all about. Yeah. I mean, so we have come so far. So we have to, you know, sort of grab that word pride and reconfigure it and wear it like a rainbow color coat again and, you know, have our heads up. And even if we trip and fall and trudge along, you know, nonetheless, we have achieved a lot. We've walked a lot. We've got a lot farther to go. But, you know, I don't want to see us kind of stuck. And, you know, when he was talking about victory of blindness, yes, that happened. And now
it's over.
And now we need to say, okay, that was true. That happened. Now what? And what the now what is that we have to rethink everything. The Democratic Party is rethinking everything right now. And, you know, we do need to move forward. I've been thinking a lot about this, actually, and the way I have sort of translated it for me is kind of in a harm reduction model. You know, in HIV, you know, you meet people where they are, and then you try to, you know, sort of have mutual respect for each other right where you are. In this instance, my harm reduction model, my base of start is Maya Angelou's poem at the Clinton inauguration, where she talked about just saying good morning to the neighbor. I think that that's a simple place to start instead of, you know, coming on.
Kindness doesn't mean not fighting.
Well, that's exactly right. And nor having an agenda. If we are a movement about love, you know, saying good morning without the disrespect, without the hatred, is kind of disarming in some ways.
Here on the pulse of this new day, you may have the grace to look up and out and into your sister's eyes and into your brother's face, your country, and say simply, very simply, with hope, good morning.
You know, this is ridiculous. Whatever happened to our humanity?
Yeah.
That's what I mean about just saying good morning as a starting place to try to, you know, bring back, to reclaim civility, reclaim decency, reclaim our humanity.
Karen Oakham, an award-winning Los Angeles area journalist.
For This Way Out,
I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
There's got to be a more.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones and Abby Dees contributed program material with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Sweet Honey in the Rock, Michael Callan, AC/DC, and Maureen McGovern performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yovana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, who all make this program possible. Check out the latest show information, special offers, and more at thiswayout.org. If you'd like a CD copy of this week's show or just want to say hello, email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Alicia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KAZU Pacific Grove, California, WERU Bangor and Blue Hill Falls, Maine, to RRR Gladesville, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
Thank you. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The world's richest 85 people own as much as the poorest half of the world's population. That is, as much as 3.5 billion people. 46% of the world's wealth is owned by just 1% of the population. In the United States, the top 1% owns 35% of the nation's wealth, while the bottom 40% owns just 0.2%. Yet, as Andrew Sayre asserts, it's not a mystery how the rich have become so rich. My guest today argues that despite their self-description as wealth creators, the rich are in fact wealth extractors. In his book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich, published by the University of Chicago Press, Sayre argues that the richer people are, the more their wealth comes from purely unearned sources, from property and finance, not to mention production. His other books include The Moral Significance of Class, and he teaches social theory and political economy at the University of Lancaster. And he joins me now from the UK. Andrew Sayre, let me start by asking you, if you will, to describe the degree of inequality in our respective countries, that is, the US and the UK.
Actually, the US and the UK have some similarities here. And as Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Sayers and people like that have shown over the last century, there's been a dramatic series of changes in the degree of inequality, especially as regards the rich and super rich. And at the one century ago, just after the First World War, the top 1% received about 20% or nearly 20% of total income. That fell in the interwar period, and in the UK fell down to about 6% of total income. But since then, and again in the US it's the same, the rich have bounded back, with the top 1% taking about 12% now of total income, and more of that, more in the US. So the rich have made a huge comeback. And it's largely at the expense of the bottom 99%, but particularly the bottom 90%.
So How do you define the rich? You just use the term the 1%, something that came out of the Occupy movement, but the top 10%, would we consider them rich as well? How do you define the rich?
Well, as regards the UK, looking at the last 100 years, actually the top 1% versus the 99% has been a key dividing line, because whenever the top 1% have enlarged their share of total income, the 99% have lost out. And that's not just, it could have been different. It could have been the top 5% gaining at the expense of the bottom 95%, or something much more complicated. But throughout the last 100 years, at least in the UK, there's been a kind of hinge point around 99%. So I would say that definitely the top 1% are the rich, but the amount of variation within the top 1% is, of course, far greater than within anywhere else. I mean, they can be people with multi-billions like Bill Gates, or people who are just getting into the top 1% with incomes, well, in the US, just roughly trying to convert from pounds to dollars, they'd be getting a household income of about $250,000 to $300,000 a year. There's a matter of degree in it. The richer you are, the more of the problem it is, for various reasons, which we can no doubt talk about.
So you've been giving us a rough sense of how we should think about the rich. Who are they? Whether it's as a percentage of the population, whether it is by income or wealth. But I wonder if you could describe for us, who are the rich? Because, of course, the image that we tend to get in the mainstream media is of celebrities, high-flying movie stars, and so on. Are they the rich, or is the rich a broader group than that?
It's not celebrities in the media, like sports stars and television and film stars. Even someone like Steven Spielberg or Oprah Winfrey, they don't really get anywhere near the top. They're certainly super rich, but most of the super rich, ordinary people haven't heard of. Okay, there are a few exceptions like Bill Gates, of course, and Donald Trump and so on, and Warren Buffett, but most of them are known only to a few business insiders. So in Britain, most people haven't heard of the top 10, and most of them are foreign, Russian and so on, super rich people who control businesses we haven't heard of in many cases. The richer they are, the more their income tends to be associated with finance and real estate, and the more of it is what I would call unearned income. But no doubt we can talk about what that is later.
Sure. One of the things that we've heard about in this country is very high salaries going to people, say, in the medical profession. Mm-hmm. And that is one group of people who are making a substantial amount. But it sounds like what you're saying is that within the spectrum of the rich, those people say making $400,000, $500,000 a year, although obviously a lot of money, would be dwarfed by people who are on the top echelons of the 1%, so to speak, whose income and more significantly wealth would be substantially more.
Absolutely. Certainly key medical consultants and other people who have very specialist skills, but also power that goes with that, and can leverage for themselves very high salaries. There's no doubt about that. But they tend to be in the bottom half of the top 1%, if you see what I mean. But to get into the top half, you really need other sources of income, like financial securities and the income which they give you, bonds and shares, derivatives and so on, and also property, capital gains and such like. Any get-rich book will tell you that the best way to get rich is not simply by working hard. In fact, maybe you don't need to work hard. It's by getting access to financial assets, which will yield you lots of unearned income.
Right. And we will be talking a lot more about that. In fact, that's sort of the centerpiece of your book, How Are the Rich Rich? But before we get to that, let me ask you, how do the rich spend their money? Because that has a significant role, not just simply as an individual question, how a certain person may spend the money that they have, but it actually has a societal impact.
Yeah. Well, if you're a billionaire, then it's very difficult to spend all your income. At least it is hard to spend it on things which you'll actually get to use in a typical year. For example, you may have four or five houses in different parts of the world, and you're unlikely to be able to stay in any of them for more than short periods. But the more you get, the less you can use them, the less point is in having them. And maybe a couple of private jets would be useful, but any more than that is a complete waste. And likewise, trying to get a bigger yacht than the next billionaire will take several hundred million, perhaps. But if you're a billionaire, that's not making much impression on your wealth. So what they do with most of their wealth is just reinvest it, and they're seeking new sources of further capital gains. They might invest in property, not in order to live, but just to take advantage of the inflation of its value. So once you get into the multi-millions, it becomes harder and harder to spend on things which you'll actually use. In other words, it's money beyond purpose, in a way.
Andrew Sayre is my guest. He's the author of Why We Can't Afford the Rich. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So then the question which you touched on, you mentioned that the rich have not always been as rich as they are now, and that if you look over the 20th century, in the earlier part of the 20th century, the rich were quite rich. That then changed mid-century and then has become concentrated again at the end of the 20th century and into the 21st century. So can you tell us then why the rich are as rich as they are now? What has happened?
In the 1920s, the interwar period, labor grew in strength. The political enfranchisement of labor meant that it had more influence. It was more possible to tax the rich and to reduce their share, huge share of national income, and also to reduce their wealth. And particularly with the New Deal and the Second World War, that changed economies and changed attitudes as well. So for people to sacrifice themselves for the country in the war, they expected a better life when they returned from the war. And the shift in power towards labor, particularly with the Reconstruction after the war, made a huge difference as well. And we experienced in the UK and in the US in the late 1940s through to the 1960s very high rates of marginal taxation, which young people today would scarcely believe, over 80% and over 90%, even in the US. So very high earners were very highly taxed. And yet capitalism was very successful in that period from the late 40s through to about early 1970s. That was the most successful period of capitalism, in fact. But capitalism also got into trouble in the sense that globalization meant that industry could run away from well-paid labor in countries like ours, to East Asia and so on. That weakened trade unions, labor organization. And also rates of profit in rich countries were also falling in productive industries. And as David Harvey has argued, capital started looking for other outlets, particularly in property and in financial assets. And with the liberalization of finance in the 1970s, that gave them free rein to do so. And so you had a shift away from a kind of productive capitalism after the war, after the Second World War. Starting in the 1970s, late 1970s, towards what I would call a rentier capitalism, in which simply controlling assets is the key way to get income, rather than investing considerably in productive industries.
Well, listeners to this program will be familiar with the critique of neoliberalism, which you've been talking about over the last 40 years, and the characteristics of it, from change in regulation, financialization, a kind of project of what perhaps could be called a class war from above. But one of the things that you stress, Andrew Sayre, in your book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich, which certainly is less stressed in other analyses of neoliberalism, including radical ones, is that a key component actually had to do with the composition of the 1% wealthiest people, and that the wealth became even more concentrated at the top of the 1%. Why is that significant to you in your analysis?
Well, yes. I mean, I agree with lots of other people on the basic features of neoliberalism: marketization, privatization, liberalization of financial markets. The market is the default or optimal form of organization. And also with the kind of cultural changes which your local author, Wendy Brown, has written about.
Sure.
of how we all are expected to become little entrepreneurs of our own lives, looking after our human capital and so on. But I think there's a third thing, which is not simply a shift from labor to capital, but to a different kind of capital, in particular the rise of finance and the way in which getting wealth by controlling assets, as I mentioned earlier, that other people need, or which yield streams of unearned income, is seen as the key way to enrich oneself. And that's come to the fore hugely in the last 30 or 40 years, with finance taking up so much more of economies than they used to do. And whereas previously they were primarily a support for productive industry, providing credit, oiling the wheels of industry and so on, and investment, now it's largely a self-serving, extractive sector. It extracts wealth more than it contributes towards the production of wealth.
Well, we will talk more as the hour goes on about capitalists who make their money from finance and who don't. But I want to just zero in on the key argument at the center of your book, which is an argument about how wealth is created. There is a whole set of beliefs which are very commonly held that those, certainly in the United States, that those people who are rich because they have earned their money. They are people like Steve Jobs, who have created enormous amounts of money through the brilliance of their own vision, and that the money that they make, therefore, is rightfully earned. You make quite a different argument in the book, which is that we need to think again, in a way that hasn't been done perhaps in centuries, about wealth as the product of extraction. So I wonder if you could contrast those two arguments, one about capitalists as wealth creators, or as the term they like, entrepreneurs, and then capitalism and the wealthy as those extracting wealth.
Well, first of all, what is wealth? It's not simply money. Money is a claim on wealth. Wealth is useful goods and services, at least economic wealth is. And some of them are sold, some of them are not sold. So when you have public schools, free state schools, then wealth is being produced. Useful services are produced by teachers, and they're consumed, as it were, or used. They benefit other people. And that is wealth. That is part of wealth. Ordinary people producing or contributing directly or indirectly to the production of useful goods and services are creating wealth. And what money does is give you a claim on wealth that is produced by other people. And most people get their money from wages and salaries for contributing to the production of goods and salaries. And so they're getting something back. Whether it's as much as they contribute is another matter, but they do get their pay is conditional upon contributing in directly or indirectly to the production of goods and services. But you can also get money without contributing anything new. If you can get control of some property, say you buy some, you already have a house, but you have some spare cash, you buy up a lot of cheap housing, and you start renting it out to people who can't afford housing, then you're not actually providing anything that didn't already exist. You haven't created anything new. You are using your power in controlling those resources to get unearned income. And there are situations where you can get both earned income, that is income conditional upon producing goods and services, and unearned income, but you can get a bit of both. And chief executive officers may, to some extent, contribute to the provision of goods and services. They may be quite important for that, and maybe Steve Jobs was, although he didn't do anything on his own. But also simply by virtue of their power, by virtue of the existence of hierarchies and they being the people who happen to be at the top of them, and they may be very good at being at the top of them, they can use that to lever extra income for themselves, which is effectively unearned. It's not in exchange for anything. So someone who controls a firm by virtue of being owner or being a manager is getting paid not only for what they contribute, but simply on the basis of having power, because it's hard to stop them. And as long as, in public companies, as long as managers provide shareholders with rising value, share values and good dividends, then they're going to be allowed probably to rake off quite a lot for themselves. And Steve Jobs and people like that, yes, in some ways may say they're quite admirable, and my criticism is of them is much less of than it is of people who overwhelmingly get their money and without contributing to production new goods and services. So by contrast, there's a Mexican super billionaire who's sometimes been at the top of the world wealth list, Carlos Slim Helú, who took over the Mexican telecommunications system. And that gave him instant access to what was effectively rent coming from the millions of people who had to use that service. He wasn't actually providing anything new. So that's rather different. But you can get money simply by virtue of power stemming from control of assets. And a big company is an asset. But I would also add, it's always important to remember, and I think some people like Jobs will occasionally recognize this, that they were also the beneficiaries of living in a society with a very highly developed science and infrastructure and education system and so on. And they also couldn't do anything on their own. There were lots of unknown people working for them who made important contributions as well, but who are not in such positions of power to take as much income as he could.
Well, and staying with him, because one of the points that you make in your book is that we should be critical of the rich not because we want to revile them as individuals, but because structurally there's something very wrong about having this class of people who are able to have the power and wealth that they do. So staying with someone who might be more appealing, like a Steve Jobs, the presumption is if he is getting a much larger slice of earnings than whatever he would have contributed himself, then the presumption is that there are other people who aren't getting that. Is that right? That if wealth is being transferred to the rich, it's got to come from somewhere. Where does it come from?
Yeah, well, as the neoliberal thinker Milton Friedman said, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And if you do get a free lunch, that is at someone else's expense. So if you're basically living, for example, off rent or capital gains on property, then you're getting free lunches. You're getting something for nothing. And I think we should use that term, that phrase, something for nothing, against the rich rather than against, as it's usually used, against people on welfare. So just as a child can only get a free meal if its parents provide it with one and do the work of buying it and preparing it and so on, so someone who gets a free meal through inheritance or capital gains or something like that can only get that windfall, that free lunch, if there are other people producing wealth. Because say you get $100,000 of capital gains on some property and you can actually realize that, then if you want to spend that money only has value if there are goods and services that other people have produced which you can buy. And they must be, obviously, goods and services which they themselves can't afford to produce. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any left over for you. So do you see what I mean? That unearned income can only exist if others are producing more than they're getting back in their pay.
So in other words, the majority of people are producing a surplus that then gets transferred upwards.
Yeah.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We'll take a music break and be back in a moment with Andrew Sayer. Listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Andrew Sayer. He's the author of Why We Can't Afford the Rich, published by University of Chicago Press. So one of the key distinctions, and you've touched on it already, is the distinction between earned and unearned income. And I wonder if you could tell us why this term fell out of circulation. It's not a term that we hear in the mainstream media in discussions about the economy, economic crisis, or in even inequality. So when was this distinction more significant, and what happened to it?
Well, it began to be used, I think, in the late 18th century. And right through, it's very common in any writing about politics and economy into the early 20th century, and the so-called ethical socialists like R.H. Tawney and J. A. Hobson would often refer to this, and it continued after the Second World War as well. And in fact, I don't know about in the U.S., but in the U.K., on our tax returns, when we fill them in, we have to distinguish between unearned and earned income. And unearned income embraces capital gains, inheritances, rent. And by rent, I don't mean, you know, paying rent to your landlord to cover maintenance costs. That's perfectly reasonable that you pay for maintenance or pay for the towards the original construction costs. It's also interest. Money's rent. Banks create new money to lend out, and the cost of doing so is negligible, but they can charge interest to you on it. And also profit on production, simply by virtue of controlling production, the owner or their delegates, delegate managers, can skim off profit for themselves. This is a form of unearned income just based upon ownership. So with people like Jobs, just to go back to him, Steve Jobs, I mean, you have to ask, well, if they weren't owners or part owners, how much would they get? And one can imagine that normally they get considerably less. But, that distinction is extremely important. Why did it fall out of use? Well, it's hard to explain an absence, of course. But one has to be suspicious with the rise of neoliberalism, increasingly dependent on unearned income, and trying to, with the idea of popular capitalism, to make it generally part of life. And to some extent in the US, at least with stocks, I understand that quite a lot of ordinary American citizens play the stock market. Well, they are small-time rentiers. They are living off a certain amount of rentier income, although probably not making a huge amount out of it. They're not the big-time ones. But it wasn't in order to appeal to people. The term unearned income was perhaps seen as unappealing. And people like to believe that what they get is what they deserve. And so you can imagine, well, this is very common in Britain. So in a place like London, which has a ridiculous housing market where the house prices are going up 10% or 13% per year, and people get capital gains, and they tend to think, well, they deserve it, so that they've been prudent, or that maybe they're underpaid at work anyway, so it's okay. They're loath to believe that this is something for nothing and at someone else's expense. In effect, it's siphoning off or free riding on other people's work. They're loath to believe that, but then nobody's telling them that. That's why I wanted to write the book, to tell them that actually they are the free riders. So I don't know about any kind of conspiracy, but it is interesting to say the least that over the last 30, 40 years, just at the very time unearned income has started to grow again, the term falls out of use, or the distinction between earned and unearned income falls out of use.
Well, and it's interesting that language does seem to be an issue in perhaps obfuscating some of the distinctions about how the economy actually operates, that there are a number of words which have dual meanings, and that within sort of popular use of language basically gives wealth and power often a pass. You mentioned the term investment and wealth. Why should we be a little careful about how we use these words?
Yes, well, I think the easiest one, there's three. There's earnings, investment, and then wealth. And earnings is the simplest one, and I think some people notice this. When a hedge fund manager or something like that says they've earned so many tens of millions or something like that, or some cases billions, a lot of people will say, oh, yes, earned, or just got, just procured, if you like. And we have two meanings to the word earned in English and in many other languages, apparently, where on the one hand it means what you get from the market. On the other hand, it means what you deserve. If I say I earned that $1,000, I really earned it. That implies that I say it with emphasis, I'm implying that I deserve it. I didn't just get it by virtue of my position. But it is it's an important distinction. And okay, it's always going to be fuzzy. How much should we get is always going to be a contestable thing. But in many cases, it's perfectly clear that just by controlling a resource or by being the child of a super rich person, getting an inheritance, you're getting something for nothing. And then I think actually the most important of all is the word investment, because it's one of these words which always sounds good. And if you're an investor, it sounds like you're some kind of benefactor, or social benefactor, and a very clever, prudent person as well. And there's some kind of happy conjunction between private self-interest and the public good. But it's actually used in two very different senses. And one you could call the wealth creation sense, where you actually invest. Well, in the 18th century, it might have been canals, and 19th century railways, and so on, and textiles. And now we invest in things which actually produce benefits, like improving broadband systems or something like that. So, or teaching people, training people so they get new skills. That actually creates objective benefits. And then there's the second sense, which is to do with wealth extraction, where it's all looked at from the point of view of the person providing the funding. Whatever brings you a return, a positive return, is an investment, or certainly a good investment. And it doesn't matter whether it produces any objective benefits, any wealth creation or not. You're not concerned with that. If you're a so-called investor on the financial markets, then you don't care whether a billion pounds comes from mere wealth extraction, unearned income, or whether it comes from actually contributing to objective improvements in infrastructure and training and the way we live our lives. So, and that elision, if you like, between those two meanings is extremely important, because it allows people to pass off wealth extraction, which is merely provides them, say, with some interest on some savings or something like that, as an actual contribution, a form of wealth creation, in fact, in the economy. And that's often not the case. The two can go together, of course. And I think if you do risk some funds in a productive investment, then I can't see anything wrong with getting some share of the benefits of that. But if you're merely using your money, for example, to lend out for someone to buy some existing property, well, you're not actually creating anything new. You're just taking advantage of your strength relative to their weakness and making them pay you for it, give you some unearned income. So that's the second one. Wealth, the third one, I think I effectively explained that earlier, that real economic wealth is actual use values, as political economists call it, goods and services which actually benefit people, whether it's teaching or whether it's cooking or looking after elderly people or producing food or software and so on. And then wealth in the financial sense is a financial or monetary claim upon those goods and services that you can get people to sell you them. And that's quite different.
So in terms of the mechanisms through which wealth is extracted in our societies, you mentioned rents. Then you also write about interest. And there historically has been a long critique of interest, quite a lot of it actually coming out of religion, right, about usury. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about why interest is a problem for society in general.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the amount of interest, the rate of interest, makes a difference. If it's only 1%, and it's that is real interest rate has taken into account inflation, then that's less of a problem than a 10% interest rate or a 20 or a 1,000%, which sometimes with payday lenders you get. So it depends upon the amount, how serious it is. But let me give you a striking homely analogy, if you like. If you're hard up and you can't pay your bills, and you ask a comfortably off friend, can you lend me $1,000 so I can pay my bills? And this friend said, well, yeah, okay, but I'm going to charge you 5% interest, and if you don't pay me back in a given time, I'm going to seize some of your assets equivalent to the value of the loan plus interest. Well, it would be pretty clear to you that that was the end of the friendship, wouldn't it? That this person, this so-called friend, was taking advantage of your weakness. And both the religious and secular critiques of usury boil down basically to that argument that the terrible thing about usury is that it allows the strong to take advantage of the weak. And obviously, as I said, it's a matter of degree. If it's 1% interest, it's not very much. It doesn't really matter much. But if it's many, many, much higher than that, and if it actually impoverishes the debtor and allows the creditor to demand work for them and to dominate them. And we do see modern examples of this, and I actually think the Greek episode recently was an example of the creditors dominating the debtors in a shocking, quite shocking way, which fits totally with the critique of usury. It exemplifies exactly what the critique of usury was getting at. So there's that kind of moral economic argument, which I think is still really important. But also, interest is dysfunctional, as Keynes argued, and it's hardly radical. It's a kind of deadweight cost, payment for nothing. And also, what a lot of people don't realize is that private banks create money that they lend out, and they're not actually lending other people's money out who've left deposits in their banks. They're creating money, which is virtually costless. They just type in some digital, some money into people's accounts, and then they get paid back, but they get paid back with interest.
Can you explain how that works? Because I think a lot of listeners would say, but wait a minute, so banks are creating essentially fictional money that they're lending out. How is that possible?
Well, because they're allowed to do so. And 97% of all money now is digital money, and only about 3% is cash, coins, and bills, and so on. And they do it just by typing. When you take out a mortgage, a loan for a property or something like that, or a car loan, auto loan, what they do is type so many $1,000 into your account, and you pay that back, but you pay it back with interest. And maybe you're paying back interest over 20, 30 years. And that's quite considerable. And that provides the bank with unearned income, basically. And there is also big questions about lending money against property, which just very often just tends to inflate its value, especially with housing, most particularly. And that has dysfunctional effects as well on economies, that increasing amounts of wealth are just tied up in property instead of being used for productive purposes to produce new things, including new houses. So banks create money. I think initially central banks were reluctant to acknowledge this, but the Bank of England now acknowledges, and American banks have now acknowledged it, they create money. And I think that's finally out into the public domain at last. And that's a very important power. It's important to be able to create money. If everybody stashes their spare savings under their mattress, then the amount of money in the economy shrinks and the economy suffers. It's important to create money, but how you create it and what you create it for is very important. So in Britain now, with the election to the Labour Party leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, there's a big debate about quantitative easing, which is money creation. And it's been done to benefit the financial sector previously, creating money to help bail out the financial sector. And there's been very little criticism of it. It's just been seen as technically necessary. But Jeremy Corbyn, as and many on the left, are arguing that it should be used carefully for supporting important infrastructure investments, which actually provide long-term benefits, especially as regards renewable energy. Creating money is very important in societies, and it's important to have democratic control of it, rather than just leave it on the basis of extremely powerful banks being able to do it wherever it happens to benefit them and increase their power.
Andrew Sayre is my guest. He's professor of social theory and political economy at Lancaster University. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and we're discussing his book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich. That's published by University of Chicago Press. So you've been describing in this hour how the rich, and especially the very rich, draw their wealth from primarily unearned income that takes various different forms. Rents is one, interest is another, production is another one. And there's so much to discuss here, but I wonder if we can turn, because the hour is running down, to talk about something which I think is a key dimension of what you're arguing and why you think this is such an urgent question, which is the environmental impact of the rich. What kind of ecological footprint do the rich leave?
Well, as you get wealthier, you spend more, and not surprisingly, your carbon footprint tends to get bigger. So the richer individuals are, the bigger their carbon footprint. And at a worldwide level, the top 7% of earners, which includes a lot of just reasonably well-off people in the rich countries, the top 7% of population worldwide are responsible for 50% of emissions, which is also interesting in that we're about 50% over, or rather we're double what the Earth can actually absorb in terms of greenhouse gases. So we're producing twice as much in greenhouse gases as the Earth can absorb. But half of what we're producing is produced by that richest 7%. So here it goes beyond earlier in the book, are targeting as the rich and super rich. But the rich are involved not only through their consumption, but through their dependence on unsustainable growth, and in many cases, quite specifically, in their dependence on investments in fossil fuel extraction. So in order, for example, to get repaid your loans and get interest on all the loans that you've made to people into the future, then that really depends upon future growth. The economy's got to grow in order to make that affordable. So that makes it all the more unsustainable, because it's in a very simple point, which I think the Pope made, which is that quite simply, exponential growth in a finite world is an absurdity, and we have to face up to that fact. The idea of green growth, where we can continue to grow but without growing our carbon footprints and so on, is a pipe dream at the moment. Yes, we are managing to produce things with less carbon, but population growth plus increasing consumption is far outstripping the reduction in carbon intensity of the stuff that we consume. So this means that certainly the rich and the super rich have to consume less, but we've got to stop that investment in fossil fuels. And we also need a kind of economy which is not dependent on growth, which doesn't crash immediately. Growth slows up as it has done in the last 5 years.
Well, I'd like to ask you more about how you think we could get to that, but let me ask you this question. So you're arguing that we need to be turning toward a kind of steady state economy, that the exponential growth that is characteristic of the societies we live in is not sustainable. One question, though, that comes to my mind is, you were talking earlier about the rich using their wealth in unproductive ways, through rents, for example. But would it be better if they were using them in productive ways, given that that would increase growth?
It's a kind of paradox, isn't it? That on the one hand, I'm saying that they're too rich and they're not spending their money on productive uses. But if they were to spend it more on productive uses, might not that just speed up?
Right.
Yes, it might. It depends how it's spent. And so we really have to have a kind of wartime mobilization of investment in green technology, coupled especially in the short run with a reduction in consumption levels by the rich and by the rich and the well-off, so that we don't expect to be able to make several long-haul flights per year. We don't expect to have second and third homes and jet skis and other wasteful things like that. We do actually need to do things like eat less meat, because it's extremely inefficient way of producing calories, and also very bad for greenhouse emissions and so on. So this is the world is indeed at a crisis point. And I'm not talking about the economic crisis here. I'm talking about the climate crisis, because if we tip over beyond 2 degrees Celsius increase, it's almost certain that we'll have runaway global warming, which is impossible to stop. And that is a terrible future for our children and future generations. So it does require back to basics thinking and drastic measures, and all this to be done very quickly, which is, I know, asking a lot, but things are really serious, and I don't think most people are taking climate change nearly seriously enough. They think that, well, that's a minor problem that can be dealt with on the way, just by getting a little bit better insulation in your house or something like that, or having low energy and light bulbs. And that's not going to do it. We need drastic action quickly.
Well, let's talk about, since you're saying these things are all tied together, really, the political implications of thinking about how to reduce the power of the rich. You write that certain concrete steps would go a ways toward reining that power in. What would those steps look like?
Well, with rent, I would have kind of land value taxes, which have been advocated not only by the left, but actually by some figures on the right, like Henry George, of course, and even Milton Friedman said a land value tax is the least bad tax. So you tax away those free lunches, if you like, and return them to the public who effectively paid for them. And interest, where interest is concerned, that's tied to credit. I think credit needs to be brought under democratic control to not totally, but to a significant extent, so that it's used for funding necessary productive investment, particularly in the foreseeable future, with an huge emphasis upon sustainable energy, sustainable ways of living. And as regards other forms of unearned income, I think ensuring that employees and users of products and services should be the key stakeholders, not absentee shareholders. I mean, it is absurd that shareholders are the almost the only stakeholder. You know, I can buy some shares in Monsanto or whatever, The money that I pay doesn't go to Monsanto. It goes to the previous owner of those shares. I'm not invested in the company at all. But I then get a bit of power over what happens to Monsanto if I buy a lot. And I get this unearned income in the form of capital gains and trading shares and dividends and so on. I should not be a stakeholder. It should be the employees and key users or representatives of users. And it's a question of justice, but it's also functional for the economy, that way you're more likely to get an economy which is serving the public rather than providing a kind of disservice. And I think it's very important that with that, people like Gaurav Porovitz have argued, we need much more cooperatively organized economic organizations. So there the workers clearly are the prime stakeholders. And one of the attractive things about them in a no-growth future is that they can survive without constantly expanding. They can stay at one level. And that would actually probably also mean that there would be less competition, and I think we need less mobility of capital. Competition can be a good thing. It can raise standards and should be retained in many sectors. But there can be competition between competing cooperatives. And internationally, competition, again, is a very mixed bag in terms of its benefits. So we do really need to rethink economies rather than just assuming that business as usual is the only possibility.
Well, I'm afraid we're entirely out of time. Andrew Sayre, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
I've been speaking with Andrew Sayre. He's the author of Why We Can't Afford the Rich, published by the University of Chicago Press. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches social theory and political economy at Lancaster University in the UK. I'm Sasha Lilly. You've been listening to Against the Grain. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
Wisconsin Nature Notes from the Nature Conservancy. What is singing, blooming, creeping, and crawling in the Badger State?
In winter, most of Wisconsin's bald eagles migrate to where the food is. And the best ice-free restaurants are near dams and power plants where open water abounds. Because so many eagles congregate at these sites, eagle watching events are now held on the Mississippi River in Cassville, Prairie du Chien, and Ferryville, on the Wisconsin River in Sauk Prairie, and along the Fox River at numerous locations between Neenah and Kaukauna. Today, bald eagles are absolutely flourishing in Wisconsin. But it wasn't always this way. In 1782, America adopted the bald eagle as its symbol. That year, the eagle population crashed from an estimated 100,000 nesting pairs in the continental United States to only 487 nesting pairs in the late 1960s. Between 1968 and 1973, along the 260-mile stretch of the Upper Mississippi National Wildlife Refuge, there was just one nesting pair. In 1969, it became clear that DDT was linked to the eagle's profound population decline, and Wisconsin became one of the first states to ban DDT, helping to trigger a national ban in 1972. It's been an amazing turnaround ever since. Eagles steadily increased in number after steps were taken to protect them. They were removed from Wisconsin's endangered species list in 1997 and from the federal list in 2007. By 2013, the last year for which we have a complete count, a record 1,343 occupied eagle nests were documented in 67 of Wisconsin's 72 counties. Sauk Prairie began the tradition of designating a winter weekend for watching these amazing congregations of eagles. This year marks Sauk Prairie's 29th annual Bald Eagle Watching Days. It takes place on January 15th and 16th. If you've never seen dozens of eagles in one area, intent on giving you a great lesson in how to catch fish, this is your chance. Don't wait too long, either. By late February, many adult eagles will be returning to their nesting sites. There, on average, they will lay their eggs by April 1st. Learn how you can take part in conservation in Wisconsin. Go to Nature Conservancy's website at nature.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Nature Notes is the work of the Nature Conservancy in Wisconsin and Mind's Eye Audio in Madison.